call the meeting to order here. First business is, did everybody have time to read the minutes from the last meeting? See any changes? Motion to approve?
I make a motion to approve.
All right, second?
Second.
All right, minutes are approved. Thank you. We're going to kind of follow the general rule this evening, so I'll make it refresh everybody's mind. We're going to have a presentation by staff. The committee will get to ask questions and make any comments that they want, and then we'll go to the public for public comment. And I wanted to compliment everybody that's been working on this and the string of emails and everything. The research that the public did on this issue is outstanding. You guys did a great job, and really appreciate it. It's nice to see that kind of involvement. It really helps us. So thank you very much, and for sharing it with others, too. That was great. Before we start on COBIA, I'm going to give you some background information I got from the Mid-Atlantic Council when I was on it last or a year or so ago. I think part of our big problem here is the MREP estimate, and we can see that it's 155% of whatever it used to be. So MREP came before the council and told us that under their new methods, the landings for recreational catch were going to be 3 to 5 times higher for everything, or just about everything, than what we're accustomed to. To me, that means MREP is really wrong. But that's the that's what we have now to go on instead of MRFs. They're not doing their they're still doing the phone call part of the survey, and they're following that with letters that they're sending out. They think they're going to get a lot better response by sending letters to the fishermen. We'll see how that works. They're not using the letters yet. They didn't use them in the COBIA analysis. But it looks like when they do, the numbers might go even higher. Now, to those of us on the council, when they told us that we were 3 to 5 times what we thought we'd been catching all these years, I think the thing that they didn't account for, the thing that cast doubt on their numbers is if we've been, and this was, they were talking about flounder at the time, if we're catching 3 to 5 times the flounder that they said we had been catching, and the stock hasn't crashed, and we think we're taking out as much as it can stand and still be healthy, then there's something wrong with the number. But that's what we got. The good news is the National Academy of Sciences, which is what drove them to go from MRFs to MRIP, is reviewing MRIP right now. It's going to be sometime in about the middle of 2018 before they're finished. But the MRIP numbers are getting a second going over, so we may have to live with this problem for a little while, but there are some very smart people trying to at least see if it's right. So we'll start with that background. You have a presentation for us, I believe.
And let me follow up on that a little bit, just to make sure everyone knows that one part of MREP is here this year, and it's already started. So this agency and all the other state agencies inherited MREP from National Fisheries Service. There used to be a contractor, the last one from North Carolina, RTI, and we now are running the assignments, they're called, and things have changed a lot about MRIP, and they're still changing. It's evolving. You know, I know that it's really evolving. What Jeff said, there's a calibration study being done where the county households are still being called, but this mail survey is a companion to that. And that's what they found out on a preliminary way, that the effort is much higher on each mode. The 3 to 5 is which mode, whether it's shore, whether it's charter, or difficult to know what that all means, other than pandemonium at some point, because by 2018, that's when a lot of decisions will have to be made. These stock assessments that you hear about, they're going to have to figure out how to deal with the changes in effort. We don't have any expectations on the outcome. I think the initial expectation, if you were a recreational angler, was that, well, if the effort's higher, then that must mean somehow the recreational fisher will get a benefit. We don't know that yet. What it could show, and we talked about this a little bit today, with the type of models they're now using, it could show that fishing mortality rates are even higher, too. So we all have to wait and be patient. And, you know, my thought on MRIP is that it will get there. It's being used for quota management, which is tough on a recreational basis. We always had a tough time with striped bass, especially because it was February when we knew what happened the past December. So that's about as far away from real-time management as you can get. And, you know, we just have to see. It really gets very complicated, and, you know, we'll know more as we go along. I haven't had a presentation yet this year. It's still early, but typically the National Marine Fisheries Service has come to the Mid-Atlantic Council, made several presentations. ASMFC will do the same. So the situation with cobia, which we're, you know, all interested in, I look back at my emails. I think in February the 5th it was that you'll hear this name again, Michelle Duvall from North Carolina. She's on the South Atlantic Council and is an employee of the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries, and also is on the ASMFC. She advised the ASMFC on February 5th or 4th that there was a real problem with cobia, which we had told you about the high landings before that. But Michelle was the one who said, well, you're over this quota. And we're going to use the word quota, even though what you read is ACL. To keep it simple, let's just call it a quota, because that's what it is. It's a landings quota. And what Jeff has is probably a little bit high, because there's a data treatment now by the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is the authority for what's gone on in federal waters for June 20th, the closure. But also, National Marine Fisheries Service is the one who can tell us what any changes are that will extend our season in Virginia. So we're sort of the third tier in the management scheme. You have National Marine Fisheries Service. They are, through federal law, letting the South Atlantic Council know what has to be done. The South Atlantic Council has the management plan for the South Atlantic stock of cobia, and then we're in there with the other states from Georgia to New York. And practically, if you look at any data, it's Georgia through Florida, Georgia through Virginia. So we're in that situation where we only have so much autonomy. But I looked, and our first email chain started a week after that with Joe Cimino, and then it kept up. And then a lot of the public did get involved, and we tried to keep the information going. The whole time, we were well aware that we couldn't really say what's going to help, other than saying we hope certain aspects of management measures will help, which I'll talk about in a minute, because we weren't the ones who were doing the analysis, and we're not. It's National Fisheries. So you're going to have a presentation from Brian Jorley in a little bit. A couple of things. There's a new data set, mainly than what we're familiar with, because the National Marine Fisheries Service has a different data set to work with, which will be explained. MRIP numbers are there, but they're really using weight data and other aspects from the collection for the southeast region. And so we were 56% of the overage in 2015. We're now 47% because of the way the data have been worked up. That's one change. The total quota of 630,000 pounds for the Georgia to New York stock was exceeded by just under 2.5 times at 1.54 million pounds. Who was involved in the conference call on the 10th? Was anyone listening to that conference call down the south of Atlantic on the 10th? Okay, you were. So it'll make a little sense. Okay, that's good. It'll make sense to you that one of the things that Don Carmichael presented was that the, if you look, and I have a small, I don't think Ryan has this, but I have a small figure that you can see. That's what spawning stock biomass is doing, okay? So he was alerting everyone that, yes, you can fish pretty hard on cobia for a few years, but it is going to start to take spawning stock biomass down.
Would that be in our presentation?
No, it's something that I have.
All right.
I think Ryan has a presentation.
Would you show it to the audience,
please? I would be happy to show it to the audience. Watch this. Here you go. So what you're seeing is a ratio, really, between spawning stock biomass and MSY and spawning stock biomass. And you can see that we're about at the lowest, if you start here in 19, it looks like about 1981. And this is the trend the last 2 years. And so John was instructing everyone at that meeting down in Georgia that that's not a great sign. And at the same time, the other sign that's not too good is fishing mortality rates have risen to the point where you know, you're going to be pushing on overfishing more than just 2015, which is a large overfishing event. I'm going to plow through this if that's okay.
Can you make one comment on that chart?
Yes.
That just goes through 2011, doesn't
that's
it?
Right. That's right.
When the last stock assessment
was
done.
You know that 2013, which you're going to see from Ryan, if they had this quote in place, it would have been overfishing in 2013 and 2015. So your expectation should be that that trend continues. So, yeah. Right. There are these little items called accountability measures, and I had one of our fishermen say to me, "You never told us about the accountability measures." And you know, I think everyone knows there are quotas for just about everything. The accountability measures for cobia started in 2012, practically. They were decided on in 2011. A lot of the Mid-Atlantic Council accountability measures started right after 2008, Magnuson. So accountability measures are just sort of lines in the sand that if you go over a quota, I'm just going to call it that, then there's some way that you have to pay it back. In the case of cobia, it's a season. So in the accountability measures, it already said to exceed the 2015 quota. If that happens, there will be a closed season. And that's what you're seeing. You're seeing a closed season. If you listen to the council meeting, the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council meeting, you may know the difference between what's going on in 2016 and what's going to go on in 2017 and later. At that council meeting, they talked about things such as, let's look at one fish bag limits, which we already have and have had for many, many years, but this is for the whole entire area. Let's look at boat limits. Let's look at what raising the minimum size would do. Let's look at the combination of these measures, and let's framework them. So what they mean by framework is they're going to be working on 2017. So they will get started and come up with changes, management measures for 2017. It's not as if the expectation that we'll bite the bullet in 2016 and do whatever we can to get a longer season, and then 2017 opens up and it's, you know, back to what we had in 2015. That's not going to happen. South Atlantic Council is going to framework new management measures that will constrain the landings to the quota. So that's already on their agenda. That's what's going to happen. And if you weren't on the call, you may not have known that. The other thing about the call, and I really congratulate the efforts of North Carolina. They've been working with us for several weeks, to the point where while Ryan and Joe and Lewis were working on ways to think about what might be able to happen, North Carolina is doing the same, sharing with us, and to the point where Michelle Duvall, if you listen to that meeting, there were probably four people who were really talking the most, speaking the most. Michelle was one of them. She sent me an email and she said, here's my number, call me if you want to do anything. But I also had her email. So at the meeting, we were all on the phone, we were able to send Michelle our options. And you wouldn't have heard much of that. So, you know, again, very neighborly to say the least. Michelle kept on talking about Virginia and what Virginia might need. Don't leave Virginia out. I had one complaint about this process, that we don't have anyone to represent us down there. Well, North Carolina certainly did, but we also have, there's a person on the Mid-Atlantic Council who is there specifically to represent Mid-Atlantic waters. So we also have the help of that person, Dewey Himmelbright. So there was a little bit of relief, at least in our camp, that we had that going on, and we had that ability to work with Michelle directly, and then she would pass on the information. About the data, private boats were 91% of the 2015 landings in Virginia, 91%. 18% of the landings were from federal waters, 82% from state waters. That's important to remember. Most of you already know that. The idea of the what happens, because that's been a big question. The comments such as, well, this happened in federal waters. We're okay. Well, that's not the way it works. Georgia and South Carolina close immediately when the federal waters close. The language from NIMS is that the other states will use their authority to essentially take their turn with what happens with the fishery. What that means to us here at VMRC is we're very familiar with challenging federal law, mostly as bystanders, thank goodness, although at one time here in Virginia we did go out of compliance for about 5 hours, and that's the track record of going out of compliance. In the ASMSC, there have been 5 cases where states, or the same state in some cases, went out of compliance. The most recent one is Delaware with American Eel, and what happens is everyone has to come back into compliance. You're working with federal law. That does not mean there aren't opportunities which are aside from the management agency, where National Marine Fisheries Service has lawsuits, you know, like this. I mean, many, many lawsuits. But from our perspective, we definitely want to accommodate whatever goes forward with the final close season. So to talk about that, there were a number of measures that we looked at and provided to Michelle. So tonight, really, we're looking for your feedback on the measures that we passed along. One was to ensure that the size limit could be looked at from, I'm going to use fork length, from 34 to 37 inches. So 37 inches from what I know is probably 42 inches total length, because we have total length. So 33 is the starting point. So they'll look at 34, 5, 6, 7. What effect does that have? And then the National Marine Fisheries Service will do this. And then they'll look to see what's that mean in days that you don't have to be closed. The second thing that we passed on to Michelle was to look at a vessel limit anywhere from 4 to 1 cobia per vessel. And again, the only guidance we had were all the emails, which essentially said, do what you can do to make sure we have some season in 2016. We also will look at the combination of those through National Marine Fisheries Service, so they'll look at the interaction of raising a size limit and the vessel limit. And the last one that we asked for was to delay the start of the season until the 1st of June, and to see what savings that might give in terms of getting past that June 20th close season. We want to hear your thoughts on those before tonight. I don't know how much else we can ask for, so if you come up with alternate ideas, it's a matter of me going to National Marine Fisheries Service and say, you know, if you don't mind, we also want to do this. And we'll do that, but I don't know how it'll work out. North Carolina, earlier in the week, asked National Marine Fisheries Service to also look at the options that we provided for their state. So they're going, it's going in tandem. I think the hard part here is waiting, because typically we can find out what this is going to mean in terms of extra fishing days, but now we have to wait. And I don't have a timeline, but because I know it won't be by March 22nd when this is finished, our schedule that we're proposing is to have a discussion with the commission similar to what you'll have tonight, same information from us, more or less, and ask for a public hearing on April 26th. By that time, and I would expect, you know, I'm hoping about 10 days before that, we'll know from National Marine Fisheries Service what we're facing as far as having more fishing days. And we're certainly in good standing with having that April 26th hearing, because that's going to be in advance of anything that we do here in Virginia for cobia anyway, as far as fishing. So that's a lot of information just to have an introduction. And if you have any questions, let me know. I have some other staff members who really have been working diligently on this, and you know, I think you'll benefit from the information that other staff members show you and kind of the interaction we'll have throughout the evening. So,
great.
Without further ado, I'm going to have Ryan make his presentation. And I'm not sure you've met Ryan. I think this is the first time here. Ryan's relatively new to the agency. Did his master's at the University of Florida, and you know, we count ourselves lucky, because the last time you looked at us, I had to tell you, you know what, we don't have many people working. Well, now we have a few more people working, and then I'll make one announcement, which is really interesting. Right now we're at our staff level from 1991, same amount of fishery staff we had in 1991. Before mandatory reporting, before the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission started in 1995 with gray trout or weak fish compliance, and then moved it up to where we're talking about 18 to 20 species that were under the shepherding of the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Service. So the same amount of employees, But there was success at the General Assembly. We will have three additional employees as of July 1. They will be statistically oriented, computer savvy, and also help with our, you know, our nine quotas that we have to manage. And, you know, that's going to be a new dawn for us. So, and John Bull, who worked tirelessly at the General Assembly, said, with these employees, we'll be holding our own. It's not as if we're going to be a superpower at BMRC and Fisheries Management, but we'll be holding our own. So I wanted to pass that news on to you.
Thank you. Welcome aboard.
Thank you. Trial by fire. So I think Rob gave a really good synopsis of this, and I hope that this presentation can serve as filling in some gaps, kind of going into a little deeper in some of the stuff that he said, show you some graphs and tables. But I think the general spirit of this is to say, here's what happened in 2015, here's what we can do about it in 2016 and beyond, given the framework that we're working under, because, as he said, this is federally managed, federally cooperatively by the states, but, you know, they're, we do have to answer to them at the end of the day. So, as Rob said, ACL is basically just a quota. It is split up by sector. Commercial gets 8%, recreational gets 92% of the Atlantic coast. And when it was split from the Gulf in 2012, so as it included East Florida, the quota for recreational was almost 1.5 million pounds. Commercial had 125,000. And as a result of that 2013 stock assessment, they moved Florida out of the East Florida out of the Atlantic stock and basically said, okay, now Georgia to New York, you're going to have your own quota. And as you can see, Florida took about maybe 60% of the ACL on its way out the door. And what that did was it, I mean, it's not for us to say whether that was fair or not, how much they took, but what that did was it took away a little bit of a cushion because, you know, you'll see in one of the graphs later that there were times when Virginia was pretty high up there in catch, but, you know, because Florida had that huge chunk, if they were down when we were up, it wouldn't lead to an overage because, you know, we basically just traded numbers a little bit. So as it stood last year, recreational had 630,000 pounds to work with, and obviously we blew by that a little bit. Out of the 630,000, we caught 1.541 million pounds. I think as Rob alluded to earlier, that if you were to do an MRIP, quick MRIP search, you'd get a number that's about 1.7 million. And the reason this is lower is because the Southeast Regional Office used a different average weight. And so regardless, it was still over by a lot. And the result of that is the federal waters must close when this annual catch target is released or is when it's reached. And that's basically a more conservative version. It's generally more conservative. It could be equal to that ACL, but in this case, it happens to be fewer fish just because it's basically trying to play it as safely as possible. But that date happens to be June 20th, and as Rob said, this is resulting from those accountability measures, which says that if you have an overage with your stock and it exceeds the total, which is recreational plus commercial, then these accountability measures kick in. The downside to the commercial sector only being 8% is that it doesn't take much of an overage from the recreational sector to exceed that combined number. So the result of that is the next year, you have to close it when that limit is projected to be reached. And as you can see, that number is actually 500,000 pounds. And so it's, you know, more than 100,000 pounds less than what we would have gotten this year had there not been an overage. So the regulations are actually pretty darn clamped down at the moment, but because of those accountability measures, those are rules that come down from National Marine Fisheries Service. That's what we have to work with. And when they do their projections and say, when do they think we're going to meet the quota, they're looking at 500,000 and not 620,000, which is what it would have been in 2016. And so to try and be as clear as possible, I think repetition is the key to to make sense of this stuff. They're working on the ACL, which is in pounds, and they're using the MRIP effort estimates. They're using the MRIP landings in terms of numbers, but when they're calculating the weight, they're using their own supplemented form of weight sampling. You've probably heard the warnings from the MRIP people themselves that their weight estimates are generally not as reliable as their numbers estimates, and so Southeast Regional Office has done its best to sample more and create a little bit better, more robust of an estimate. And the implication of that is, as you saw in a couple slides ago, that ultimate harvest estimate that you get from a NOAA posting is going to be a little bit different from if you just went on the MRIP website and did a quick query. So we're trying to make that distinction because it can be really confusing when you're looking at numbers that are all kind of similar. And here is a representation of the catch over the last 10 years. So that yellow line, the one that's a little bit lower down, is just Virginia's catch in pounds over the last 10 years. The blue is the entire Atlantic stock, so all the states, Georgia through New York. And that red line, I hope it's not too confusing, but that's a 2015 recreational quota. That line, that limit was not in place in years past. I just kind of drew it across the entire plot just to show that there were years where if we had had this quota the whole time, then we would have been over. And I think the point to be had there, similar to what Rob was saying with that spawning stock biomass, is, you know, let's say 10 years ago, we had a surplus of cobia. There was enough where if we exceeded the limit, nothing bad would happen just because there were a lot of fish out there. But John Carmichael was warning, if you start to hammer these fish, eventually you're going to get to a point where they are in an overfished state. And as you can see, between 2010 and 2013, and most obviously last year, we kind of have been hammering them. And so that declining stock combined with increasing catch is going to accelerate that process by which it gets depleted. And so it's definitely something to keep an eye on. And as you can see, for 2015, Virginia's catch has exceeded the entire coast's quota. And so Virginia by itself really, really clobbered them. But if you look at that blue spike too, the increase in blue is actually bigger than just that yellow. And what that means is basically there were other states that had higher catches than the previous year as well. And so that kind of goes into why this closure is happening so early. But I guess just another little point that's neither here nor there is that even if we had had our old quota of 1.45 million or whatever, it still would have been over. Even if we had Florida's quota but not Florida's catch, it still would have been over. So this really was a particularly high year in terms of effort, and that's why you're seeing a number like June 20th. To try and be a little bit more clear about how that date was reached, they looked at data from 2013 to 2015. And if you look in the regulations, they actually, not only are they not expected to do that, but they're not really supposed to do that. Because the quota changed from 2014 to 2015, they're not supposed to use that old data because it's no longer doing apples to apples comparisons because you're working on different effort, different amounts of catch. But because this last year was so high, they didn't want that to just totally blow it out of the water. So while some people may feel that they don't understand the plight, and maybe they don't, they at least acknowledge that there is a problem and that they need to do their best to keep the economics of the region in mind. And so we're using 3 years of data, and basically they split it up into those two-month waves that MRIP samples with. And so for all the March and April, they took March and April of 2015, March and April of 14, and March and April of 13, averaged those catches together, and then split it up across those 60 or so days in that two-month wave. And so that's how they did that. That's how they basically set the pace and figure out how fast are we going to be catching these fish in 2016. And so basically North Carolina, for example, they're catching their fish earlier. Georgia's catching their fish earlier. South Carolina's catching their fish earlier. So when you look at this June 20th and say, well, if Virginia caught most of the fish, how the heck is the season closing before Virginia even starts really hitting into cobia? And the reason is North Carolina caught almost 600,000 pounds just in May and June alone. And, you know, that's, they were bumping right up against the entire coastwide quota by themselves for just a two-month span. They ended up with about 630,000 pounds for the year. South Carolina was at maybe 125. And then obviously Virginia was the heavy hitter. But, you know, once again emphasizing that the reason it's closing is because other states contributed and also because we're working on a smaller number than you might be expecting. It's not when are we going to reach 630, it's when are we going to reach 500,000. So, obviously, I know a lot of people don't trust the MRF data, and maybe with good or bad reason, but I think this table is telling because when you look at, you know, those, when you look at the last 10 years, there are other years where Virginia really hit cobia. So if you look at the third column over, that says total harvest, A plus B1, weight. If you look at 2006, that's actually, according to MRF, we caught more than what we caught last year. And the only reason there was no big blow-up about it was because the whole quota system and accountability measures, none of that stuff existed. And so you look at that, you look at 2009, that was the most trips we ever had at 102,000. But obviously we're here to talk about 2015, and I think one of the points I like to make about this table is that if you look at that column with the red bars in it, PSE, that's the proportional standard error, which is basically MRIP's way of telling you how confident they are in the data, how reliable is it, how much could it be deviating from that number that you see in the column to the left. And so the lower is better. The lower the number, that means the less it's going to vary, and that means the more confident they are in it. And as you can see, with 2015 being at 39%, you'd have to go back to 2010 to find a number that they were more confident in than what they saw in 2015. So, not saying that 2015 is 100% on the mark, but when you compare it to years like 2014, 2013, and most certainly 2012, we're looking at a better sampling effort by MRIP. And this is just another way of looking at it. I just took the last 3 years because that's what Southeast Regional Office is doing. That's what, you know, it kind of marks a little break in the fishery where we started going under new regulations. The first row is just trips targeting cobia. And so this is MRIP sampling alone. And so what that means is that there were 153 trips in 2013 that MRIP samplers got where somebody said, my primary target was cobia. Not that they caught it, just that they were fishing for it. But I think the point is that 2015 had 170. So out of the last 3 years, this was the most that MRIP had captured cobia, which may or may not make sense because most people believe that there was a lot of effort for cobia last year. And the second row, trips where cobia was caught, that's just the number of trips where somebody came back and said either I caught one or I caught it and released it alive at sea, whatever it might be. But, you know, they got a cobia. And as you can see, there's not a huge difference, but once again, 2015, there were 39 trips where a cobia was caught that MRIP sampled. And I think an important point there is that only two of them were from the charter mode, and the rest were private boat. And so the MRIP estimates, you know, between the split of 91% private boat, 7% charter, the rest whatever, that percentage is about there, but I think the thing we have to be careful of is if charter boat guys are catching more, then we're actually not including that higher catch maybe as honestly as we should be. So, you know, we may have dodged a bullet there in terms of, you know, getting a fully confident estimate of the landings. But, you know, I think to wrap it all up, we're looking at a situation where in terms of sample size and in terms of error, this is more representative than 2014 and 2013. And so a lot of guys are saying, well, 2014 and 2015 felt the same. How could 2015 be so off? Well, that's assuming that 2014 is the more correct of the year, and we don't know that for sure, especially considering they're actually making those estimates on fewer samples. So probably didn't convince a lot of people to trust the MRIP samples, but the fact is that's the framework that we're working with, and so I think it's useful to go through this exercise and say, well, how could the estimated harvest have gotten so high this year? And as Rob said earlier, NOAA Southeast is using different weight for cobia estimates. And so when you look at their landings, they're actually going to tell you it was 720,000 as opposed to 862,000. So that's a little bit better from Virginia's standpoint, because it could have been even worse. And another thing is, this is, you know, according to the samples, the heaviest cobia on average that people were catching in, you know, the last 5 years. This is a graph that just says year by year, out of all the cobia that were caught and sampled, what was the average weight of them? 2015 is the highest. That's the heaviest cobia we're seeing. That number in 2015 is 34 pounds. It was 29 pounds in 2014 and 27 in 2013. And so obviously, even if you catch the same number of cobia, but on average are 5 pounds heavier, that's going to increase your harvest estimate just a little bit. And then, you know, while tournament citations for cobia is not any sort of proof of you know, it's not any quantitative analysis, the fact is, if you look at 2015, the bar all the way to the right, you're seeing that the releases and the captures for cobia citations are still pretty high, higher than the last few years. That's working on a 55-pound capture citation and 50-inch release citation. So they're still catching big cobia. That doesn't say once you get above 50, this plot doesn't tell you exactly how big they were. But if you look at that, to the right of that dotted line is when they implemented more restrictive citation regulations. So before 2004, it was easier to get a cobia citation because they didn't have to be as big, and that's why you're seeing overall the numbers are a little bit lower. But, you know, just a conceptual picture that people are still reporting big cobia. But I think another probably more telling result in why this harvest got so high is that directed trips increased by 25%. So people were going out and fishing for cobia considerably more than in years past, at least according to all of these estimates. And, you know, out of all the people I've talked to on the phone, exchanged emails with, I think everybody's in agreement that cobia fishing's gotten pretty darn popular in the last, you know, 5-6 years. And so it's possible that people just are entering the fishery now. They see the towers on the boats. They see the sight fishing and fun fish to catch, fun fish to, really good fish to eat. And so it could just be new guys that are in the fishery for good. Another possibility is just other recreational opportunities in the Chesapeake Bay and the, you know, Atlantic Coast are not as good. Summer flounder's been down. Two really cold winters that knock back, you know, speckled trout and puppy drum. And so it could just be guys are saying, well, shoot, cobia is the best thing I got to go for right now. And when those fisheries pick up, people might go back to those. It's hard to say. And we don't even know that this is the reason, but, you know, it's just, you see this increase and you say, well, what the heck could be causing it? And, you know, it could be a combination of these factors. But certainly your intuition is that, yeah, cobia fishing has grown a little bit, and there are definitely guys going out. And with sight casting, you may have a higher percentage of getting them. So it's certainly a possibility of explaining that. And so whether or not all this is what's actually going on in reality, we're under this management structure, and we have to do something about it. And so moving forward, as Rob said, we're kind of waiting on analysis. We're trying to figure out what we can do and what we're willing to do. And so at that meeting last week, South Atlantic Fishery Management Council said, okay, let's ask our friends at NOAA to do something about this and look at different types of regulation changes and see what that buys us in terms of number of days added on to this shortened season. And so Southeast Regional Office right now is looking at not only regulation changes that would push that closure back to a later date, but they're also looking at different combinations of regulations that might be a more permanent measure in 2017 and beyond. Now, that could be the same as what we decide in 2016. It could be different. Only time will tell. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's being looked at right now. And when that stuff comes back, we'll have a really clear picture. But there are some things that we can look at now and kind of get a gut feeling. As Rob said, pretty much as soon as this situation blew up in the beginning of the year, North Carolina said, all right, we're going down to one fish bag limit. And folks at NOAA did the analysis with and without that regulation change. So assuming North Carolina was still at 2, and then assuming that they're at 1. And that didn't lead to a big reduction. It only added 2 days on at the end of the season. But a thing to keep in mind is that in North Carolina, and really for the entire coast, the majority of trips that are getting sampled, people are only catching one cobia. So going from 2 to 1 isn't going to prove much. And maybe it will in reality, but when you're just looking at this data that we have at our disposal, most of the trips, it's just one cobia. So, you know, that bought us 2 days. It would be June 21st if South Carolina and Georgia also adopt the same measures. And then pretty much the four big states that are contributing would all have a one fish bag limit like Virginia already does. But I don't think that's going to help us much, you know, especially considering cobia fishing often doesn't pick up till the end of June. And so looking at vessel limits, looking at size limits, I can tell you right now, looking at the MRIP data for the past 3 years, that, you know, going down to 4 or even 3 as your vessel limit is not going to lead to many savings. In 2015, looking at MRIP's raw data, there were only a couple trips where people reported keeping more than 2 cobia. In 2014, because of the lower number of samples, the highest trip catch was 1. And 2013, there were a couple trips that had 3-4 cobia. But, you know, the point is, looking at this data, we can't prove that a boat limit reduction would lead to that big of a decrease in catch. And, you know, it could be that we're not really sampling the charter boats as much as maybe we'd like to, or as much as would show that result. But I think the point is, a size limit increase is probably going to hold the most potential in terms of showing that 2016 would be different from 2015. So then it really comes down to, what are we, you know, what are our anglers interested in doing? What are we willing to accept? Keeping in mind that this may just be for 2016, it may be pressured into just making it a permanent change for 2017 and beyond. But I think, as Rob said, the fact is it's going to be a little bit different following this year. So we'll have the analysis ready for the, well, not we, NOAA will have the analysis back before the April Commission meeting on that number from, you know, 34 to 37 inch fork length, which is, you know, you can see here, this is the conversion from fork to total length using Virginia's recreational fishery sampling. It's based on, you know, 1,600 cobia caught over the last, you know, what's that, 26 years. And so you look at 34 fork length, that's between 38, 39 inches. And if you're going up to 37, that's, you know, effectively that's a 42 inch total length size limit, 5 inches up from where we stand now. So thank you guys for listening. And obviously I'm sure there's going to be some questions. So if there's something from a previous slide, we'll cycle back to it and go a little deeper.
Well done. Thank you. Spell your last name for me, please.
J-I-O.
Okay.
R-L-E.
Thank you. All right, any questions from the committee?
Please. I have a comment, not a question. This is
next, okay.
And this is from Tom Powers, and I'm sitting in Tom's seat, who asked me to sit here. And his comment is, and it's followed by a recommendation. From 2003 to 2012, the commercial fishery averaged something like 7,000 pounds of harvest. In 2013 was 11,000. 2014 was 23,000. His comment is, we do not need a commercial fishery to grow while the recreational fishery gets closed for months at a time. At a minimum, the commercial cobia fishery should be capped at a 10,000 pounds, which is 1,000 pounds higher than any year between 2003 and 2012. And in his other comment, he wanted to remind the other committee members here that he's a little frustrated that when we went to the one fish limit for the recreational fishery, that there was a verbal promise to keep an eye on the commercial hook and line fishery and ensure that there is not any substantial growth. So I just felt obligated to get Tom's comment out there.
Jeff, I spent a long time up here when we shepherded in that six fish vessel limit for a commercial hook and line fishery, and I spent a lot of time at that time talking about ACL and the management for the commercial fishery, because we are accounted for in the coastwide ACL for the commercial fishery. And as far as Tom's concern of growth at a state level, there's no state-by-state allocation. And, you know, we're talking about the sector that has 8% of the allowable harvest, and they're staying within that. So, you know, I think we also have a very good chance at being able to, I know there's a lot of concern about exceeding the commercial ACL this year. It's certainly possible, but not surprisingly, we as a state are pretty good at managing our commercial quotas. As we've mentioned, the number of those keeps going up. So, you know, North Carolina and Virginia are, once again, large contributors to that sector's ACL. Federal dealer reports are done weekly. They're turned in weekly. So, you know, I've talked with Michelle Duvall about the possibility of even creating commercial permits that would allow us to track that, and even, you know, even closer than at the federal dealer reporting levels. And I think there's some willingness to do our best to monitor this commercial fishery that's, you know, never been an issue as closely as possible, especially in a year like this. And there are ways that we can do that. You know, a couple examples would be what we did with speckled trout, where we have dealers turning in reports for those months where the fish are present. But, you know, personally, I don't see I don't see Tom's concern for growth in a fishery that's stayed well within their ACL for, you know, 8% of the overall allowable harvest. But.
All right, Joe, so you think that you can restrain them to their 8% without much?
I think we have I think we are poised to manage this as a quota just as well as we do any others, and there are a few things that we can do to help that. You know, one of the other things that we can think about that this fishery doesn't have, since we would be asking buyers to report, is to perhaps put in place a retail permit as well, something like we did with eel, where about 50% of that fishery is sold retail, so we don't have buyer reports. But those individuals that sold their catch directly to restaurants, we could have them report just like the buyers are reporting to really make sure that we're tracking this quota as closely as possible, I would think.
Well, that's comforting to a point, but we're all having to cut back, so we'll have to see how it works out. Thanks, Joe.
Well, I think if the concern is above 10,000 pounds, obviously it's a little bit difficult to handle, but, you know, if the concern is we don't want them to go over their 8%, I mean, the fact is the whole quota is 60,000 pounds for the entire coast, and Virginia got to 20,000 pounds this year, but, you know, the way cobia move up, Virginia's basically getting last ups at this. And so if North Carolina and Virginia adopt some sort of, you know, permitting, some sort of measures that track this, Virginia's only going to have a small slice, not small, but they're only going to have a smaller slice of that 60,000 pounds anyway. So it kind of effectively acts as a cap because a bunch of them have already been taken out by the time our commercial guys even have a chance of getting to them. So, you know, I think that kind of natural effect combined with that sort of weekly reporting we could keep a pretty good eye on it.
Okay, good points. Any other questions from the committee? I was going to ask you if there were any questions in the audience. And for the audience members, if you have some other reasons as to why or if you have witnessed an increase in concentration on cobia, we'd like to hear about those reasons as well so we have them in the record. Yes, sir. If you could come up and give us your name, we'd appreciate it. Yeah, we got to put it on the record.
My name's George Ed, and what else did you want for your record?
That's good.
Just my name?
Yes, sir.
The one question I had on your slides, you showed some numbers that were highlighted that you said showed their
I guess, how reliable their they felt their data was, and those numbers varied anywhere from the 30s up to the 70s, it looked like. Those numbers didn't mean anything to me. Can you explain how much faith they do have in their data based on what those 30s and 70s mean?
I can. It used to be a standard by ASMSC for strike bass was they wanted those PSEs, proportional standard errors, to be within 20%. And when they changed over from the what was known as MRS to MRIP, what they found was all the old MRS PSEs, or proportional standard errors, were a lot higher. So at this time, no one has said exactly what is an acceptable PSE, proportional standard error, that they used to say for MRS. That's still in the works. I think what Ryan was showing you was that at 39% in 2010 and 2015, much better than other years. So it's a relative situation. We don't yet have a definition of whether a very acceptable proportional standard error should be 30%, 35%. That's not determined.
So
what it means is when you have an estimate of landings, like 1.5 million pounds, it means that there could be a higher or lower amount by that proportional standard error. But that is the center point. That's what they use.
So that is a percentage. So if it's 30, the number was 30 up there, that was they could be off by 30%. So if it's 1 million pounds, they could be off by 300,000 pounds. Is that correct?
Roughly it's
right.
In either direction.
Right.
So the numbers were, most of the better numbers were upper 30s, 39. So they could be off by up to 40%.
You spend a lot of time, and I've been part of this with Black Sea Bass, where you can make the case that, well, gee whiz, they're 30% lower. And then someone says, yeah, but they might be 30% higher. And it's a never-ending situation. That's why in all management, the ASMSC, Mid-Atlantic Council, South Atlantic Council, they are just going by whatever that is. And if it gets up to be, I would say if it gets up to be above 50%, then you start to really say what's going on. And the more you sample, so this is what Ryan was talking about, the more sampling that takes place, the better those PSEs will be. And the problem that I heard over and over again, that for those who listen to South Atlantic Council, the real problem is that they kept saying, hey, this is a pulse fishery, meaning that it hits and it's gone. 2 months in Carolina, we get a little bit more, but the real crux of the fishery, and especially down further south, it's a pulse, so it's harder to get the samples. The other thing I heard a few times was everyone say, yeah, you got to admit, this is a rare event species, meaning that MRIP can't, it's not like croaker, where you can go in Virginia from March until, you know, late October, November, and find croaker to sample. It's you just have a short window to sample. So that all contributes to what the PSEs are.
Yeah. If I add a little further clarification, I don't know if it'll make you feel more comfortable or not, but if you have a PSE of 40, it's more likely, if it's off, it's more likely that it's off by 10% than 40%. So the farther away you get from it, the less likely that is to happen. So to give an example, let's say we're at a stream and I say, how wide do you think this stream is? And you say, oh, it's got to be 100 yards. It's more likely that if you're off, it's because it's 95 yards, not because it's 10 yards wide. If that makes sense, if you're estimating, you're probably going to be pretty close to it, right? And so if you said, oh, what's the width of this balloon? And I say, oh, it's probably 10, 15 yards wide. Probably not going to be 10 yards wide, right? It's a little bit larger. And so if you have an estimate that's based on a lot of data, a lot of samples, the idea is that the more samples you get, the more you're honing into what it actually is, and the less likely you're going to be off by a mile, you know?
But we don't have very many samples. We had 100 and something samples, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand that.
And just the other point was, I think there at the end you started talking about the commercial fishing, and somebody might have made the argument, if I understood them right, that when they come up the coast, they're going to be commercial fishing, and by the time they get to Virginia, we may have a small percentage of the catch anyway. It's my understanding that all those states are two per commercial angler, and VMRC changed our regulations a year or so ago to go to six per commercial card holder. So my thought is that a lot of those states to the south of us are not going to be encouraged to commercial fish cobia. It's almost not worth their time and effort and fuel and expenses to go out there and catch two fish per day. Once they get to Virginia, these guys that can catch six per day, one guy, are going to be
making a
living.
I think that's partly, so partly okay. It's still two fish for the commercial fisherman registration licensee. It's six for the commercial hooking line. So the commercial hooking line is 200 individuals. Not all are cobia fishermen, but the rest, the commercial license is two fish.
I understand that a lot of the best cobia fishermen in the bay have gone and got their commercial hooking line license, so they
So what we have to wait for is the fact that there were 85% of the quota on the Georgia through New York, 85% commercial, and that's why Joe has indicated we have to step up our monitoring, because we don't want to be in a state that blows out the commercial quota. So it's going to take a little more effort to make sure, given what you're saying.
That's all for me for now.
Thank you very much. Anyone? Yes, sir.
Ryan, on two quick comments. Ryan, on your slide on the cobia citations, can you bring that up?
Sure.
It's very quick. Just for 2015, he shows that it's up, but between 2012 and 2015, we have had zero fish in a 100-pound class. The same time period for a 90-pound class fish, we've only had five. 3 years prior to that, for the 90-pound class, we've had 15. And in the 100-pound class, we had four. So the quality of the bigger fish is going down. And that's due to the amount of effort. I just want to make that point.
Yeah, there were a couple, I mean, and we're still kind of scratching our heads about this, but there were a couple 100-plus pounders in North Carolina this year. And we even went back to the Emirate. The actual North Carolina people went and asked the samples, are you sure this is a big cobia? And they said, oh, yeah, these are big cobia. And, you know, I'm not saying that you're wrong. It very well could have declined in the
Which
bay.
Has.
But, you know, I don't know. It's a good point. You know, I don't know what we can do to look into that, see exactly what may have happened there, because it could just be the way people are fishing. It could be that the quality of the fish is down. But, you know, if the average size of each cobia is up, it just means, you know, you're catching more that are, let's say, 60 pounds instead of some that are 55, some that are 90.
We're to assume that's the same stock of fish in North Carolina and here, correct?
Yeah. So
it's possible that some of the larger fish could have gotten caught in North Carolina prior to coming here?
Yeah, it's certainly possible. You know, they know that once they move offshore, there's a lot of mixing between them. And so, you know, definitely, you know, there's at least a small amount of exchange between all the fish on the coast. You know, there's a recent genetic study that got published a couple years ago. It said, you know, a lot of the fish that you find in shore are spawning in the same area, but, you know, these are big fish, and they can swim up and down the coast if they want to feed or find warmer water. It's just that when they go back to lay eggs, it's to the same place. So,
all right.
The second part of the comment was on the commercial aspect. For 2016, that ACL is 50,000 pounds, which has gone down.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and the recreational also went from 630 to 620.
Right, it went
so.
Down as well, but. And it's regulated. I mean, they have to report weekly. As of March 11th, already 3,934 pounds were reported for the commercials. So what could happen is that the states to our south catch all of the ACL for the commercials, and the commercial guys get completely cut out like the recreational guys.
That was my next question.
I think we need to look out for that too, and just wanted to bring that up.
Just a second. Is there any chance, Rob, of getting a state-by-state allocation?
There's always a chance. It would probably take a year and a half. You know how that process works because that's a plan amendment. That came up at the South Atlantic Council meeting on the 10th, and Roy Crabtree, who's the
North Carolina
director down there, was the one who said, well, you know, we really can't talk about certain items if we don't have a, you know, allocation system here. And, you know, but that'd take a while to do. But, if things keep going like this, then I'm sure a lot of the states will want to do that. We talked about two things. We talked about a lot of things, but two things that stand out. One are, we know South Carolina and Georgia don't really want to shoulder the kind of reductions because they didn't get that high with their departments. So, you know, they're not going to jump on the bandwagon and say, we'll go from a 33-4 limit up or anything else like that. South Carolina has taken some action on the number of fish. But, you know, it is a situation that sooner or later I can see that everyone's going to try and watch what happens in their state and get some type of share. But the other thing I want to mention, which I forgot to mention earlier, Michelle Duvall talked to Roy Crabtree. He's the regional administrator. He's the real title for the Southeast, just like John Bullard is for the Northeast. And she said, I really think it's time for ASMFC to get involved. And they talked about that briefly. It's unknown in what role ASMFC would get involved. So I can give you an example. We have Spiny Dogfish, which is a joint federal plan between New England Council and Mid-Atlantic Council. Mid-Atlantic Council has the lead. ASMFC is also in there to set state limits. And what usually happens when they're all partners like that is that they want to agree on measures because if they don't, then it turns out they have to come back and fix it. And that's happened with Spiny Dogfish when ASMFC sort of said, well, we want to go higher on our quotas, and within a year they were back because of federal law. So that's another thing I did want to mention. The idea tonight again, and I'm going to say it again so you hear it, even though Ryan has one of the slides, well, he doesn't have that slide up there right now, but what we proposed to National Marine Fisheries Service was to look at these increases in minimum size, 34 all the way up to 37. The boat limit, which Ryan did a good job explaining that because of the lack of charter sampling and because, you know, even boat trips at large in terms of number of fish, that's probably not going to carry a lot of clout. And then the other part was they'll be combined, so we'll get to see that. You'll get to see that. And then the idea of waiting until June 1 to start things up. So I don't know, will you get 10, 12, 14 days? I don't know if you really get there in May, but every little bit helps. So really tonight, that's what we want to hear. We did take the lead to pass on those proposals, and I'll reiterate that if you have something else that you think we missed, we'll certainly make an attempt through National Marine Fisheries Service to get that looked at. Okay. So, thank you.
Thank you. Ernie?
I want to explain a little something to the gentleman down there. The reason the commercial went down is because the recreational exceeded. Let's just say, we'll make it a simple number. Say there's 100 fish. It's safe to catch 10. It was 15 caught. So somebody has to make up for that difference. So now you're not working with 100 fish. You're working with 90 fish, and you get a percentage. So we're getting 8% of 90 fish instead of 8% of 100 fish. It's not because the commercial went over. It's because the total allowable catch was exceeded. So the number has to be justified somewhere, so they take it across the board from everybody. So they're actually paying, the commercial is going to pay back some of the stuff. I mean, and that's just pure mathematics. It has nothing to do because I know a lot about fisheries management, but there's no need in me getting into fisher mortality rates and stuff. This is just a simple way to do it, just pure mathematics. As the stock number drops because of possible overfishing, everybody has less. They don't hold out, well, this group didn't go over, so we're going to let them keep going where they're going. No, they drop it down to the same percentage on everybody, and that's the reason the commercial catches went down. They only harvested 85%. They were not over.
Okay. Thank you. Do you have some other presentations, Rob, on this topic?
No, do not.
Okay. Anything else from the audience?
Yeah. Is this the time for public comment now?
Yes, please.
So we are open for public yes. comment?
Yes. Oh, well, let's take his question first then.
My name is Chris DeMasi. Could you go to that slide that said how many boats were asked and how many caught fish? So in 2015, 170 boats were asked, or there were 100 trucks.
170 interviews where somebody said,
out of 170, 39 people said, yeah, we caught fish that day. Mm-hmm. And the average fish was one fish per day, pretty much, or they caught one fish.
Well, yeah, there were, in 2015, it was a lot of one, but let's say they released two.
Okay, well, If you add, so 25% of the time going out fishing, based on those numbers there, people caught one fish. Mm-hmm. And we caught 880,000 fish pounds last year, right?
Yeah. So 720,000. We'll go with that because that's what's going to
be. So that's almost 20,000 trips were done last year based on weight.
Yeah, here's the.
Yeah, based on the weight and whatnot. I mean, that's 180 trips a day. I just don't see how the numbers can justified that 39%, just ridiculous in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way that, or I mean, I was never asked at all. I've probably fished 20 days a month last year.
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to point that out that the numbers are really skewed, I think.
Yeah, well, here's you can see for this number right here is how many people they said in Virginia took a trip for COVID. So 92,000 trips for the whole year.
Yeah, I mean, if 170 people are asked.
Yeah, this is that Everett expansion factor.
Everett is probably a telephone service. That's where the Everett comes from, and then it's expanded.
In a minute.
The catch rate is what is done with the interviews, intercepts.
Okay.
And they put them together. And they come up with the landings that you have there. And trust me, no one really has ever gotten inside that mine.
Black box.
just a question to that point. I believe you said earlier, right off the top, that this data has not been peer reviewed. The statistics have not been peer reviewed, and it's under review by
the methodology is the
National Academy of Sciences, which should not complete for about 18 months. I think that's what I heard. Please correct me.
Yeah, so in 2005, so you guys remember the old acronym MRS, the National Resource Council, which is under that National Academy of Sciences, they did a review in 2005 through 2006. And that's when they started the process of turning MRS into NREC. And after those adjustments.
Please forgive me, I'm not good on acronyms.
Yeah.
So if you could.
Everett
back to kindergarten and talk about MRS and NREC.
Yeah, MRS was the original thought.
The Marine Fisheries Statistics Survey became the Marine Recreational Information Program.
Got it. Both of those were different incarnations of calling people's homes, seeing how much they fish, and going on the boat ramps and seeing how much people are catching fish. And so all of those, that methodology, the way they pick where to sample, what kind of questions they ask, that has most certainly been peer-reviewed many times over. So this data is not peer-reviewed in a sense. The idea is if you go out and sample how you're expected to go sample according to the rules that they set out, then this data has, and even here you can see that they say, look, we acknowledge there's still going to be some error because that's
your significant uncertainty.
Well,
yeah. I'm sorry, that was
all right.
A comment. I apologize.
That's all right. Just, that's not a problem. We had another question from the committee.
Some of the people that I've spoke to, obviously, there's question about where the data comes from. How do you determine who you ask? Is it a sampling that's random? Mm-hmm. Is it something that you look and see who's catching, you know, what, when? But I guess what I want to make important, or I guess heard, is that when we're going on to create solutions for the future, because we do have all these gaps in data because they're samples, if attaching something like a permit to the recreationals, we will be able to solidify the data like we are able to do for the commercials. The reason why you know that they were within their 8% is because you had those landings. You had those records.
Yeah, and that's
so when we're going on to this procedure in the next couple years, I think it vital that those landing permits or some type of regulation be added so that we as recreationals have more legitimate, solid data that we're not forced to, you know, have surveys that are going to depend whether or not our charter captains are going to be able to make a living or not.
Yeah. So we'll both, you know, Joe and I have some comments.
Wait.
My comment relates to the past. Dr. Cynthia Jones, who was a commission member, conducted a striped bass recreational bus stop. It's called a bus stop survey for striped bass back in 1990 and 1991. And her conclusion in 1992 was that at that time there was no reason to have that type of an approach to figuring out what was done recreationally, because a survey needed to be done the way it's being done now. So I think the other part is everyone on staff in 1990, I remember it very well, filled out striped bass permits for all the recreational anglers that wanted a permit. There wasn't a person on staff who wasn't, including Jack Travis at the time, who wasn't filling out these permits. And when we got the permits back, Dr. Eric Barth, who was in Fisheries at the time, realized that we had about a 43% return rate. And trust me, I'm not selling cars, but trust me, because we have to rely on this survey, and our only impact, and it's only going to be to the start of this year, is to have the catch rate to work in the field, do the assignments, get the samples, measure the fish we can, get information on the fish that are in the cooler that we can't measure. The survey for effort is not going to be done by us. That's still going to be done right now, telephone calls, by 2018, probably strictly using what's called the registry, this phone book that we've all been anxiously waiting for that's overdue, where instead of calling randomly to county households and then finding out about 8 or 10 years ago that wasn't working because people went to cell phones and didn't have landlines. So now, by 2018, we will have a better effort partner. And then we'll never be involved in what happens out here, because that's strictly going to be what National Marine Fisheries Service does. So, I mean, I've heard it a lot. I don't think it's a bad idea on the permits. I mean, we have heard that before. It's just that the practical experience, I don't think it would get us any better traction in terms of knowing about the landings than we're going to find out here. I can tell you that because of a couple things. One, I can tell you the Saltwater Journal. We started off the Saltwater Journal with a bang, and we had a lot of interest, and folks were really interested in that. I was really crazy about it because I said, hey, we can get summer flounder lengths for the recreational analysis we have to do. Well, I mean, the Saltwater Journal interest kind of went like that. We have a charter reporting system, which started out with a bang and was requested by the Charter Boat Association, and that's done the same. So if you can imagine what it would be like to conduct the type of approach you have.
Can I say something?
Sure.
I respect everything you're saying. What I'm looking at is, yes, you've got 43% of people that stepped forward and did this, but that's 43% of logical hands-on data that you didn't have before. If it was mandatory, then you'd have 100%.
Well, then
you and then you could use that with
my thought wave
with this study.
We want to do that, and I told the commission we want to do that, but we're probably going to do it species-wise at times. So we have a striped bass permit, trophy permit. We're going to have a cobia permit in terms of a different kind of aspect, perhaps. We want to make sure that if there's a permit, you have to report, mandatory. If you, my idea is probably your idea. If you don't report, then you don't get a permit the next year.
I'm only looking at this because you've got a lot of people that see the data from Emirat. Some people believe it. I apologize. I'm not trying to impugn anybody. Some people believe it. Some people don't. We're faced with a situation now. We have to rely on it. And it's not a good situation that we're in right now.
I think Joe would tell you a few words, but I know one of the words is we can't substitute a system, but we can have reporting. And I really thought with blue line tilefish that when we revisited that regulation in 2012 that we were going to be asking for reporting. And if you even if you do a zero, you have to send in your report and say, didn't catch anything, and that's fine.
I'm simply throwing that out there to say we would be able to hang on to something more than just this at this point if we had that.
I agree with you, not a large umbrella, but I agree with you that there are species that we should do that for.
Okay.
So it took me a long time to tell you that, didn't it?
It's okay.
Rob, now that you've taken over most of the field survey work, did you say you get to do the site selections?
No. We don't get to do the site selection. This is an interesting situation, Jeff. We don't get to do the site selection. We don't do the draws, which means where you go. But we do go to the sites, and Jeff Allen's our coordinator, and he's been doing this for quite a while. He's really sharp. We do what's called pressure to figure out where there might be good activity, low activity, high activity, medium activity, and then National Marine Fisheries Service decides how you're going to sample. So the interesting part of this, and I mean, I don't mean this in a bad way, but six states were doing Everett on their own. Now all the states are doing it. And it was the ASMSC that played a little bit of cat and mouse saying, well, we're going to get you ready to do this, but we don't know where the money's going to be there. We don't know. And eventually we're all doing it. But the National Marine Fisheries Service is still in charge of what counts.
Well, I think improvements have been made in site selection now, haven't they?
Good. Yes.
Yeah. So things are getting better.
Lewis works as our what we call rec tech committee, and Lewis has been doing that for a long time. And so he's a fountain of knowledge if you have any other questions on that.
Okay.
Which is really good.
But it is improving, so things will get better.
Yeah.
I did want to mention to the new people in the audience, we keep throwing out the ASMFC and the Mid-Atlantic Council, or MAFMC. ASMFC controls state waters, anything from 3 miles off in, and the rivers and tributaries. The Mid-Atlantic Council controls the offshore waters, 300 to 200 miles. And they work together sometimes. We argue every once in a rare while. But when we mention those, ASMFC is Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, I believe. And the Mid-Atlantic Council, MAFMC, is the federal body. So hopefully that explains a little bit. Yes, sir.
I want to clarify something. Somebody in the audience made a comment that people are going and buying commercial hook and line licenses to start catching more cobia. Is that possible? I thought the commercial hook and line was closed fishery.
There are criteria set up to allow for a transfer. An individual that would receive the transfer has to have a commercial card and has to have 1,000 pounds of seafood.
So, I mean, you can't just go get a commercial hook and line license because you don't want to catch 2 cobia a day. You want to go catch 6. You can't do that.
Well,
exactly.
No, if they happen to have, if within recent, if
right,
within
okay.
the last few
I just
years.
Wanted
they've had a, yeah.
it sounded to me like the gentleman said that people were doing it. I want to make sure that people, that can't happen.
Right. There can't be a large influx of.
It is happening.
Yeah.
In fact, we've got people right here in the room that have done that. People have already purchased commercial open line license over the past several years to target this fishery. And the MRP has encouraged it by allowing them to go out and catch six per day. It has been taking place for the last several years. I know a bunch of people that have done it.
That's okay. That's what I was trying to clarify. I didn't know you could do that.
But they are available. So there's
You'd have to buy it from somebody that already has one.
Yeah, and you would have had to have landings in the previous year. So in other words, individuals that just decided this year, saw this coming, and decided that they wanted to fish for cobia. And also, to be very clear, you can't mix trips. So you can't make your six fish commercial hook and line trip. You can't take your old charter out that would have come out with you on July 4th and now just have them as your commercial crew. You know, a commercial hook and line crew needs to be registered with us at the beginning of the year. There's a total of 15 people you can register with and change that up. And, you know, one of the other discussions we had so what happened with the commercial hook and line fishery? There were individuals within that fishery that were, I believe, true commercial harvesters that have been fishing for years that said they have very few fish that they could fish for commercial hook and line, especially in the summer. If you don't have striped bass tags, you know, there's literally only two or three species that you can go after. They were allowed a couple commercial harvesters on a boat with them as part of their crew if they wanted to. They could have actually had a maximum of 8 per vessel if they had enough commercial registered commercial fishermen with them, because they were allowed 2 per person, just like all the other states, as was pointed out. One of the concessions that they were asking for was to be allowed to keep up to 6, even if there was only 1 registered commercial licensee on board. But that would, in some instances, because if they got frustrated being told that they couldn't get 6, you know, or they could have gone and got a crew of commercial card holders and actually come in with 8 per vessel. That wasn't not likely happening very often. But to some extent, you know, the true vessel limit that's put in place now could have been more restrictive than the 8 per boat at the time.
All right. Thank you. Anybody else on the committee have any questions?
Mr. Town?
Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask Dr. Neal if he has any idea how these folks are able to do this. Now, I understand how the transfers take place, but if there's a 1,000-pound prior landing,
you want
to
answer that, Zach?
I'd be interested to know this. We had a crab committee meeting here the other night, and you probably were at a commission meeting where I was complaining about the number and increase in licenses, even after limited entry was supposed to be put in on the crab fishery. We had another discussion about this Tuesday night, and now I'm hearing about another loophole in the problem. You know,
it's not a loophole. You know, we have a cap at 200 total. And I mentioned that because I seen through the post there. And he went through all the proper channels. He got his commercial card, and if I got it right, did your dad have a seafood handler's permit? That was special. But, you know, so basically, they went to, so you can get them. You can buy them.
No, I understand that. I see them all over the place. But what's the complaint then?
I don't know. I don't have a complaint.
Okay.
But I guess the concern, and there are a couple of legitimate concerns that you may see, because some of these guys are very good fishermen, but they're kind of charter boat captains mostly. That's primarily what they are. But if we're going to take away the charter season by shutting down the season, then, you know, what are they going to do? Well, you know, they're not
going to
stop fishing.
No, I understand. We have several of them at Lynn Haven, you know, that pursue this.
Fishing, which is perfectly legal, everything's fine. There is a concern, and what Ernie mentioned, you know, because of the overall commercial quota for this fishery, now, more than 50,000 pounds, and you look at what was caught last year, it was more than 50,000 pounds. And so if there's any increase in commercial activity at all, then this commercial ACL is going to be busted. It's going to be busted this year.
or if reporting can stay ahead, just like you were talking about the potential for doing something like we're required to do on speckled trout, where we have, what is it, 80% or 85-something percent, as soon as you reach that, then somebody puts the brakes on to some degree?
Coastwide thing. So with the speckled trout, that's a state. And so we get to a certain extent, we can do that kind of thing. But the problem is that if we want to do something like that, they have to monitor the entire coastwide catch. And then Virginia be responsible for making sure the entire coast doesn't go over that ACL. But no, really, this shouldn't be any comment. This is not a commercial fishing thing. This is all about commercial fishing. That's the significance of the commercial catch is not much.
The 8%.
All right. Yes, sir. Black shirt, please come up, give us your name, who you represent, if anybody.
I'm Bill Blum from North Carolina. I represent charter and commercial fishermen from North Carolina because we agreed to work together on this issue because it's a lot bigger than 8% of a total ACL. But correct me if I'm wrong, I think I've emailed you back and forth, Rob. Maybe. I'm sure you've got a lot.
I hope so.
But the biomass for Cubby, if I understand it, and all this was from CDAR 28, is unknown. Correct.
Well, there's an
estimate. It's unknown. Okay. And all peer reviews and final assessments have stated we need more data. Is that correct? And the, correct me if I'm wrong, in the 1980s, 1.9 million pounds was annually caught for cobia in the Atlantic?
I don't recall. I do know some of that historic catches.
Ultimately, my point is that they went to a 2-per-person limit, 33-inch minimum in the early 90s. And then, obviously, Virginia came under this same mandate in 1996. But even with those reductions, was the biomass ever increased?
It didn't appear so. No, the models don't suggest that. The models suggest that it's been going down.
So that downward trend that all of us was based off the same biomass we've seen from the beginning, before the per person and before the minimum length?
Well, I mean, I would think, I don't know the assessment, that's one assessment I don't know, but I think with assessments, what happens is they do these benchmark assessments, which means they can bring in all the independent data they can have, they can bring in new techniques, new modeling. And if you look at summer flounder, for example, the target, or the level of recovery, used to be 196,000 pounds of females. It's now 137,000 pounds. So what I'm indicating is the biomass you see now, and I can't talk the assessment, whether you wrote Brian or Joe can, is a function of the latest benchmark assessment. So it's not as if there's been the same assessment stream through time. And things do change, but when they change, it's obligatory that is ever doing the assessment shows why it changed, shows which independent data went into it, and in the case of cobia, since it's so heavily loaded to the catch data, what the changes were there. So, I mean, that's a general statement that applies to all species.
Okay. I actually got that, and you can look me up at Boat Up Lures. I can provide you all this citations throughout CR 28, if you want to see it. That was part of what I was tasked with, educate what the hell's going on. What the heck, I'm sorry. That was actually referenced in a peer review that the biomass or the default total assessment hasn't changed since you went from 2 fish and 33-inch minimum. Which may be a reason why we've caught more fish, because you can't keep every one that you catch, which wasn't displayed. And as far as me and Michelle Duvall, she's been great. She's answered a lot of my questions, and I'm from North Carolina. But my business is heavily relied upon the Virginia market. It's the biggest, the longest. And June 20th closure, I'll be done. There's no way. And I have three kids under the age of four. But when Amendment 20B, which brought this zone split, and 360,000 pound, there's two votes, if I'm not mistaken, from the Mid-Atlantic Council compared to Florida's three. They're not in the Atlantic for COVID anymore. You may see why we got such a low number. And as far as having one liaison in the last meeting, that's not acceptable. If there's 770 boats going out a day fishing for cobia, that's a hell of a lot of money, heck of a lot of money, that Virginia's going to lose out on. While Florida gets three boats in an open season. On top of that, I don't see why Virginia wants North Carolina's, wants North Carolina to be the voice of Virginia or do the bidding for Virginia when we're going to get most of our season and most of the economic benefit from cobia. But that was my question, and I hope to talk to you more and more.
Well, now that I didn't hear your first name.
Bill. Bill Warren.
I know it now. So, yes, indeed, we have communicated with that. But your last statement is pretty interesting. I don't know how to overcome it right now because of the way they set it up. You have the Mid-Atlantic Council that's going to have one vote down at the South Atlantic Council. But as far as North Carolina representatives go, I mean, the relationship was that we at least had someone that would say to National Fisheries Service, would you please try this for Virginia? So, I mean, that's what that's all about.
When my mouth is duct taped, I hope somebody can talk for me, too. But my last point with the Amendment 20B and the public register, it stated that ACLs would be increased. That's what the public comments were based on. And ours weren't, from Georgia to New York. And I fished over 20 days in Virginia waters, probably more than I do in North Carolina, because it is productive and fun, and I enjoy it. And it's a lot harder to catch cobia up here than it is anywhere else, especially Florida, where you can see 30 feet in the water column and throw it to them on the bottom. That's why I sell 3 and 4 ounce jigs in Florida Gulf Coast and 2 ounce up here, 2 ounce and a half. But applied, doesn't seem to really matter. But I think that's it. And then, was it ever confirmed if the Bays breeding program was factored in to the last assessment, or even the tagging program?
I can't imagine that anyone but Joe or Ryan would be up on that.
Well, just, I mean, as far as our tagging data was considered in the assessment, all of our data was. In fact, you know, we were very fortunate to be able to contribute, especially the ages. We bumped up the max age for cobia. We were the only 14-year-old cobia ever sampled. And our tagging information was integral in looking at you know, how the coast was split, although that's not the determining factor. We actually had one cobia that tagged here that was caught in the Gulf, and we had, you know, over the years, six that have been caught in Florida. And they ended up using other data needs to split it at the Florida-Georgia border. I don't know a lot about the... It wasn't exactly a stocking program, but Virginia Sea Grant did do some work to just get an idea of how feasible it was to raise cobia through aquaculture. I think from breeding through aquaculture, and it was successful. They I don't know the exact numbers that they released, but it was a very small scale thing, just a couple hundred fish, just to see how well they did in, during the breeding process and being held and fed. And they were smart enough also, them having a close association with the, us and the tagging program, to tag a lot of the fish that they set out. And, we've got some interesting stuff from that tagging.
Maryland has a program as well, so I found out while I was communicating.
And yeah. South Carolina.
Yeah, so there are other programs.
The fish could spawn several million eggs.
It's possible.
I think that is it for me for now.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Rob, what's the possibility of us having this be a joint species like we have with dogfish in the New England Council?
Well, authority has the attention of the regional administrator for the Southeast, Roy Crabtree, and it was proposed by Michelle Duvall, and they talked about it for a little while, and then I think it just takes time to figure out what the role is. But I assume, like other species, National Marine Fisheries Service would maintain the lead. Southland Council would still be the plan. And it's hard to say, but Red Drum used to be under the feds as well. Now, I can't tell you the year that the ASMSC took over management of Red Drum, but it happened. So, I think it's a matter of keeping this idea, alive and not just putting it on the back burner.
Yeah.
Sure. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Since a lot of people weren't able to listen, it was Michelle Duvall, who, as chair of South Atlantic, also sits in at the ASMFC Management Board for the South Atlantic. There's a South Atlantic Management Board. Cobia isn't one of the species. And as Rob said, Roy Crabtree, who was the regional director for the Southeast Regional Office of NOAA, looked favorably on this is a consideration. I believe, I don't necessarily want to speak for Michelle, but I believe it almost went, Lewis and I believe it was actually a motion in South Atlantic to bring it up at ASMFC. So that maneuver, I did talk to Michelle about it, would be a recommendation to ASMFC's policy board to consider it. So that's as far as it could go at, say, the ASMFC's May meeting. It's just for them to start thinking about it and then move on. I do believe it was actually a motion in South Atlantic for that to be brought to ASMC.
How would that affect the Mid-Atlantic Council sharing with the South Atlantic?
Well, I think as Rob said, since it would still stay with South Atlantic, and it's always going to be a CDAR would always handle the assessments and set the reference points. I think it would. I don't have that as much familiarity with the consoles, but you do see when they do have species, they allow folks to sit in. Even at the ASMFC level, that's when they start allowing. There are examples of New England Council sitting on some of the ASMFC board level stuff.
Yes, that'll do. Anybody else on the committee? Anything else? I'm sorry.
I got something with y'all all done.
We're not. New business, you mean?
No, on this.
Okay, go ahead, please.
In layman's terms, did you catch more fish because there's more fish out there? Or it's more effort?
The trips were up by 25%, is what Ryan shows.
The average catch.
And the size was larger. So this was done by the pound. Sorry, Liz. Go ahead. You want to say that? You got to eat the pup. This was done by pounds. So rather than numbers, so you have a higher average weight and more trips, that's what drove this.
But you don't have a new stock assessment to tell you how many fish is out there.
Yeah, there were 22,400.
Well, I think you mean what's the
bottom. Oh, no. Not that I know of. I mean,
so you don't really have a lot of data. This is a one-year deal. You don't know what'll be there. You really don't know what was out there this year. So why jump on something the first year? You need something to compare it to.
Maybe I'll let Lewis answer that. No, Yes, there are estimates of the biomass. That's how the stock assessments get done. With any of our species that we talk about, whether it's flounder, black sea bass, you know, you name it, there are estimates of the biomass, of the living weight that's out there. And there's estimate of abundance, which is usually done as age one and older. And the that's that part. But the reason that this is going forward is because in November of 2014, there was a new quota. I'm going to call it quota, annual catch limit. And that was put in place. And what Ryan showed, he had a slide up there that said, if you go over this quota, guess what? There's going to be a closed season in 2016. Okay? Now, the other part, I'll come back to what I said in the beginning, 82% of that 1.54 million pounds was from state waters. So there's going to be a pretty big price to pay if the states, because we've heard these comments, if states just say, oh, well, that's federal waters. That's not going to happen. It's not going to happen for two reasons. I'll reiterate it. One, there's federal law out there. Federal law through Magnus and Stevens Reauthorization Act can preempt state authority. It might take a little time to get their act together to do that, but they can do that. The second part is related to blue line tilefish. Why is it related to blue line tilefish? Because in 2005 and 2006, the South Atlantic Council was starting an amendment, a couple of amendments, but one amendment would have made Virginia's just kind of getting noticed blue line tilefish. It could have controlled it to a very small amount of take because it's a South Atlantic management plan. So that could happen here as well. That's the second thing we worry about. South Atlantic Council says, oh, so Virginia doesn't think it should do anything. Well, guess what? Looks like we have to revise what happens with our South Atlantic species. Now, none of that's ever going to come up. Because in the, you know, in the circle, you don't want to be put right in the middle like that. You don't want that to happen. That's why I explained earlier on, there's been five states that have bucked the system. They didn't last very long out there. They had to be, you know, come back in or else. There's consequences. We don't like it. The fishermen don't like it. But there's consequences.
But what I'm getting at is not just Virginia. It should be a stock assessment made. If somebody's catching a whole lot of fish, there's a reason for it. And usually you got a whole lot of fish.
Well, you've got a
stock assessment that's 2-3 years old, and now all of a sudden you got a whole bunch of fish, but on your records you don't show that.
Well, to me, there
should be a quota increase instead of taking something away from us.
Ryan showed was, you know, the newest stock assessment set a safe harvest level for Georgia through New York.
But when was the stock assessment?
It's with data through 2011.
11, right.
But I think everyone has admitted that since then, effort has increased on this species, that the talk of towers
because
popping up
fish,
everywhere.
More fish, know, more effort.
Well, or they just found a new method to target this species. But when you say 1 year, if you look on this graph of 10 years, 6 years out of 10, harvest was over that safe harvest level. So it's not something new that's happening. It's, you know, it's...
That's what I'm getting at.
If you increase effort, then... So you have a spawning aggregation. They are all concentrated in a small area. All these fish are coming in. There's something called hyperstability that... People that are good at catching a small number of fish, it's called shooting fish in a barrel. If there's billions of fish or hundreds of millions of fish down to thousands of fish, they are all concentrated in a small portion of the bay trying to do what they have to do. If you keep the effort on them, it doesn't have to be more fish to catch more fish. It could be many less fish, and you could be wiping them out. I'm not saying that's what's happening. But I'm saying that is a possibility here. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be.
You evidently have a good management plan, or you wouldn't have all these fish.
Well, this is part of that management plan.
Okay. So now that your management plan is working, you are penalizing the fishermen because you're doing a good job.
Well, that's, you see, the head of the head stock assessment scientist, actually, what he was trying to tell the council was, you know what, things were so good when we did this assessment that we could hit them hard for a few years. But I'm getting a little nervous because we've been hitting them hard for a few years. And if we keep this
still
up,
though,
things are not going to be
they're still catching
on.
More.
I mean, if I'm just mentioned that the next stock assessment will be done late 2017, but we probably think 2018. So you've got 2011 data, but what I showed you before is what we're being told. Now, we are not the authors here tonight at all. You know, if this was Croaker or Spot or Spotted Sea Trout or Striped Bass, we could tell you what. We're not the authors here, but we did have this, right? And this is through 2011. And now what we're being told by the stock assessment people is because fish have been hit in 2013 real hard, in 2015, expect that that is still going down. And that's what they're worried about. That's all we want to tell
you. But they don't know. They're guessing.
That's what we want to tell you.
They're,
right.
They're doing their best.
I'm not here to speak for them. That's what we want to tell you. Okay. That they told us.
All right. Thank you. Yes.
I just have a comment. Rob, have you seen this? This is scientists in Panama have released an alert. They're calling cobia an invasive species. They're comparing them to lionfish. So, you know, you can basically show this like you're showing that, saying cobia are everywhere. They're seeing them in the Pacific where they've never seen them before. And this is actually pretty interesting. And this is a scientist wrote this.
Our little friend climate change and climate variability.
Well, and also there was a bunch of cobias
that escaped from a pen. Yep.
In Ecuador, yeah.
Yep.
Afraid of going up to the Pacific.
And they're literally comparing them to lionfish.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. We have another comment from the committee then.
It's on the stock assessment because there's been a lot of talk of that. In the South Atlantic meeting, and I listened in on that, Michelle Duvall multiple times said that it's stale. You know, that was her exact word, stale. I believe someone in the meeting asked, well, when can it be done again? And I think it was John Carmichael from CEDAR that said cobia is a low priority fish. So I believe that the stock of fish is a lot better than they think because we have been catching so many. So the problem is that we have an old, out-of-date assessment. This week, Tuesday, I contacted a friend of mine. I texted him, Congressman Rob Whitman, and I relayed that information to him. I said, Rob, is there some influence that you can have on the stock assessment? He texted me back and said yes. And within an hour, he called me back. And what he is going to do, and Rob is on the Natural Resources Committee for the House, and the subcommittee that he is on water, power, and oceans. So he is going to draft a letter to the National Marine Fisheries Service requesting that that stock assessment be done sooner. I believe that will help us. It's not going to help us this year, but that needs to be done sooner rather than later. And he's going to do that. He's going to send me a copy of it when he does it, and he's going to have all the other representatives in Congress that are affected sign off on this.
Super. Appreciate the help.
I like that, and I appreciate Congressman Whitman's efforts because he's been involved earlier, too. That. So what we're going to look at, we're here in 2011 with the end of the stock assessment. We're looking at this with a spike here and a spike here, and we're going to trade it for a spike here and a spike here. And that's going to play into that. And I would expect what happens is that despite the letter, that probably still CR may get to this about a year earlier. Maybe early 2017 or something, or maybe enough to get in 2016 data, which would be really good. I heard the stale comments as well. So you know, anything helps. I mean, that would be a big help, because a lot of the comments tonight are generated at scale. And, you know, we face, with a lot of our assessment information, we're generally looking at two years in the past. By the time they're enacting something, it's already 2 years old. So now we're talking 5 years old, right, already with this. That is a bit out of the ordinary. Generally, in 5 years, what they do is a new benchmark, which I mentioned before. You know, most species are scheduled for a benchmark where they do all the bells and whistles they can find. And usually updates are occurring at least every other year at the ASMSC. So, you know, that'd be a big help.
All right.
I have one more request of Rob. I think you'll find most of the anglers generally agree with the measures that you proposed. I think they're reasonable, and I think that there's probably not too many other options you could put on the table that are reasonable to consider. My concern is that the data that comes from that is what the anglers are going to get behind, and how many more days will we get with this data? And so my request to you is, if you can put some, the more time we have between when we get the data and the actual decision at the VMRC meeting in April, the more time that we have to come together, to think about it, to talk to our fellow anglers, and then show up at the meeting, because my understanding is the decision will be made at the April meeting to set the regulations. You can't wait any longer than that. So my request to you is to please put some pressure on the National Marine Fisheries Service bean counters to give you that data sooner rather than later, and give us that time to chew on that data. And that's my request.
Ryan down here, counter. Is it bean counter?
Yes.
We'll do that, and I think what we ought to do, we can say it now rather than later, is this is important. So before the commission meeting on the 26th, you know, we need to have another meeting. I will work to have the data in hand. It's probably good to try, you know, at least a week before the commission. We've had meetings where it's the night before, and that's really doesn't serve anybody very well.
No.
You know, the 26th is a Tuesday in April. The 19th is the Tuesday before. We'll look at the 18th and 19th, if I can, and see what your availability is, and we'll sort of tentatively plan that. Now, the other thing is, we've got all your email addresses, from what I know. Some of the proxies, I'm not sure, but Denny, I know I've got your email address somewhere. So we have everyone's email address. We had a crab meeting the other night. Matter of fact, this is meeting number 3 for the Tireless Warriors to my left here, and this week. And so what I encourage you is, we certainly get emails from a lot of you, and some phone calls too, but use the relationship we have with email for a good purpose to tell us what's on your mind. So by the time we get to the meeting, you can say, well, here's what is thinking, and we don't have to spend a lot of time with you having to say it. I have always found this problematic at the ASMSC when I chaired committees, that you had to drag the information out of them when they had to do something. On your part, you're willing to give information. We're willing to have it, compile it, reply to you, you know, to get ready for this. And this isn't just about COVID, it's about FMAC overall. So, you know, that's our service that we should be providing.
You're doing a good job. Beth had a question first.
I was going to kind of branch on what Mike said. Absolutely, with especially with the possible increasing of size for the cobia, for the inches, like, you know, can we make sure we get like 42, 43, up to 45? I mean, just so that we see, is that going to extend it a week? I mean, because if you look at North Carolina, they, you know, with the boat limit only, they only increased 2 days, and, you know, so that's going to be vital on how people react to the size.
I think the North Carolina situation was just on the personal limit. So when they went to one fish, not the boat limit, when they went to one fish, it was 2 days. And when they
profiled what Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina would achieve, then you're talking about a couple more days at the most. I mean, with the size limit, our expectation is that it's going to be, as Ryan told you, it's going to be the one that counts the most.
Now, more bang for the buck.
Yes. Now, the way it's scheduled right now, what we fed to National Marine Fisheries Service is only up to 37 fork length, 42 total length. You started talking about 45 inches.
No, I was just giving that as an example. I would like to extend a variation of options within those inches, like if we go to 42, if we go to 43, so that we can weigh and measure what is the best option, how far do you want to go up type of thing.
I think that's what I'm asking you.
Yes.
The way it stands now, we won't know what a 43, 44, or 45-inch total length would do.
Okay.
Because we...
Before the meeting is what you're saying.
No. What we asked National Marine Fisheries Service was look at 34, 5, 6, and 7 fork length.
Okay.
So from the data that was shown earlier, that would only go up to 42.
I got you.
Totally.
Well, at least we'd have a better understanding with that.
If the committee wants, I'll go back to what I said in the beginning, if the committee wants to go up higher, then I will try and get National Marine Fisheries Service to add that on too.
As long as it doesn't delay. I mean, because we need the information as soon as possible. If they're able to, that's great.
That's the way that I'll state it then.
More information we have to make a decision, I think, is the better situation.
So that would be about a 40-inch fork length. Is that what we're talking about?
We can look at
the conversion.
Okay.
We got a couple others here.
Okay, well, so we'll stand with that until we hear something else.
All right, yes, please.
Rob, before you sit down, my question was just about the same thing. On other issues, you've given us a list of options to pick from.
Right.
The only other question I would have about this on size limits is, does anybody know what sort of catch and release mortality there is on these fish, being that the water's so warm?
Well, we read 5%.
Overall, it was estimated quite low. The stock assessment uses a 5% release mortality.
5%, okay. That's very low.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay.
You have a question, too?
So what we have in front of us right now is to try to come up with some ideas for size limit, season start, and bag limit. Boat limit, okay. So and we've got not much time to get it done. These are the guys out here in the audience that have the biggest stake in it right now. Have they got any numbers?
Yeah, well, that's our biggest.
Because, I mean, we've talked a lot about whether or not there was effort, what the stock size is, the data sucks. We got to live with it. We got to make some decisions. We need some ideas.
Sure. All right, Bill, please.
I'll be quick, sorry.
That's all right.
This is kind of my point of coming up here. I know it's not the most popular, but I understand an extended season benefits me. So it's to my benefit. But in the name of science and what I see, and I think even Michelle Duvall sees, is what's more than likely, because we started with such a low ACL, and she has it in writing. They've never had this situation before. So I say, how do we get a higher ACL? You know, how do we get out of this hole? It's not by lowering creel limits, vessel limits, or size requirements. The benchmarks he just talked about in CDAR 28, it says if you lower creel limits or increase size limits, it'll lower benchmarks. Well, the BAM or Buford model, if I'm wrong, please correct me. It actually, in the write-up, said that cobia are not often targeted. It theorizes one fish per vessel. It's amazing how MRP says it was one fish per vessel. But it also factors in catch history. So if the main emphasis is to reach this extremely low ACL, which is at the Chesapeake Bay, which is the epicenter of the cobia migration, that I can tell you
was the least represented information and data-wise through this whole assessment, you're only hurting yourself because the limit will factor out low, and you'll deal with this every year. You'll never have a full season, guaranteed, unless, like we suggested, was an amendment to the accountability measures and some type. And it'll take the state of Virginia to stand up and say it was a raw deal. It was wrong. For the most part, with Amendment 20B saying there's going to be increases in ACL, and there weren't. There's no way around it. It weren't for Georgia to New York, which they didn't say outright, which would increase, but they did say Georgia and Florida, I'm sorry, the Gulf and Florida would increase. So ultimately, if you really look at it from a big picture standpoint, and again, extending the season keeps me in business. Any amount, one boat, fish every other day, whatever. As long as there's hope that somebody can catch a fish, I live on. Charter guys live on. But it's not good. It's not good for science. It's not sound science. But overall, the deal in general really needs to be addressed. Florida with three votes, Virginia with two, now with one liaison, Florida with three votes. They get over 1.5 million pounds of fish a year. I tell you, I had 8 customers that I sold in Panama City and Destin that were traveling up here this year to Chesapeake Bay to fish. Destin, Florida, in the economic study in CDAR 28, was considered the biggest economic benefactor of cobia. I told Michelle Duvall, you better wake up, because Virginia was, as of last year, and would have continued to have been year after year after year. And again, 770 boats it would require to reach that poundage. Keep that. That's millions of dollars. Millions. They see, I'm not saying it as a portion of a cash fish, you know, we're going to hurt the population. We haven't even been credited or reassessed from when we went to 2 per person, 6 per boat. What do you think is going to happen if you go to 1 per boat, 40 inches? How are you ever going to get it back? That's us in North Carolina, the group, we're from Ocracoke to Outer Banks, we're in Culpers, some of the charter guys here. And again, it benefits us all to keep it open, but I think it benefits nobody to reduce the creel limit or increase the maximum size. If I'm correct, the charts they posted at the meeting, the only time the percentage went up was 1 per boat, or went up a little bit, 2 per boat. Went up a lot, 1 per boat, and then from 40 inches to 43 inches. So you may get a week, and you'll get years of shortened seasons, and well, Florida won't. So that's my spiel. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm just wondering, with the Florida and Gulf, I mean, I don't know how they, if they used all of their limit. I know it's a separate stock from the Georgia up. And what can be done in order to look into what he's talking about? I mean, in terms of, if there's any excess that someone is not using somewhere, is that an opportunity for us to say, hey, you know what, we've got the fish, and we're last on the list. We're the last people to fish for cobia.
Yeah,
and that's not our fault. It's where we're located.
What Bill just said is probably, you know, the way it would have to go. I mean, if they made all these decisions to put East Florida, you know, by itself with the Gulf, you know, you come in and try and reverse that. What I don't know enough to tell you what would be the supporting evidence. But it is true, how do you work on getting the quota, I'm going to call it a quota again, higher for the Georgia to New York area? So, I mean, I agree with that. I don't know what kind of an effort that takes either. That takes more talk with people in the South Atlantic to see how you do that. The other part is, which what Bill told you, I think we're already in for it.
right? So the South Atlantic Council was already talking about frameworking what they have, the plan that they have. And that means it's already going to start to look at 2017, as I said at the beginning of the meeting. They're already planning to have management measures that will ensure that they get to this quota. So that's why I think a lot of people thought 2016 is it. You know, we'll just do what we have to do, whatever we have to do for 2016, and then 2017 we start with a fresh slate, but we don't. That's not going to happen.
They reduced our quota in half, correct? And then now this year we're here faced with this.
Well, they reduced our quota from the quota gets reduced a little bit. The ACL, the quota from 630,000 to 620,000, but you have to fish at 500,000. So they did knock it down. But what I'm saying is whatever we talked about tonight, and I hope there's more, like Pete Amory said, some more comments about what else do you think you want to do, we're going to be under the gun in 2017. And that's why the quicker the assessment, the less likely it should be, we hope, that these framework measures don't last beyond 2017 to 2018. So we're undergoing, you know, the analogy for you, since you were here, a lot of you, is striped bass. I'll bring that up again.
That's what I was thinking the whole time. It sounds like the same story of 20 years ago.
And we had what Bobby Wiggly mentioned. We had the biomass was higher than 1995 when the stock was considered restored. Yeah, we're all taking a cut. You know, all the states are taking either 20.5% cut, like in the Bay, or 25% coastal. So, in a way, that was a one-year situation, they thought. Well, that started, we're already in our second year, right? And we're going to be in the third year. And then there's going to be an assessment done by the end of this year for striped bass. And the report card will either say, met the fishing mortality rate target or not. So, I mean, this is typical.
So what we suggest to get out of this hump or to have an extended season or whatever, is that going to be a temporary measurement, or we're just going to continue that all throughout until there's another stock assessment value? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, it's hard to tell. It,
are we going to be able to put a time frame on this, like after we look at these options?
I don't think so. I think what we're going to be faced with for 2017 is looking at what the framework says, and then typical to other species management, we'll have a choice of which poison pill we want.
Because, I mean, obviously you want to have as many fish as you can if they're there. You want maximal sustainable yield, but over a period of time, if there is any evidence of the fish being in trouble,
I mean,
you
shouldn't expect that 2017 will be as harsh as 2016, but you should expect that it's going to be a pain. There will be pain.
There will never be another 2015.
No.
Never.
All right, just a minute. The gentleman in the green hat, did you want to come up and speak? Okay. No, that's you in the green shirt.
Zach.
Wait a minute. The gentleman in the beard first, please.
Thank you. My name is Beard. I mean Rich. my quick question, I mean, we're looking at the graphs and the science and stuff like that. We're basing all our science on 130 boats that stated that they caught 39 fish. And what they're saying is we exceeded the entire limit by catching 862,000 pounds. We in Virginia have about a four-month fishing period. I don't think any cobia fishermen will argue. We're pretty much a little bit of May, but June, July, August, September. That's our fishery. If you do break down the math on that with, I think it was 93,000 trips, that would be 772 trips per day, every single day, broken down over a 120-day season. When it's overcast out, when it's raining, when it's blowing, you're not cobia fishing. 90% of the people cobia fishing are sight fishing. There's not many people chummy when it comes down to that. Our stock assessment is almost 5 years old now, and it's just interesting that in November of 2014, they came out with an accountability plan, and then our season in 2015 and everybody else was just completely off the charts. I mean, I don't believe in coincidences in this world, but that's just interesting that it comes way after the closure before the 15, and now it just so happens to work out for everyone else, especially Florida. My question is, why won't the VMRC just completely tell the AFMSC that we will not comply
until sound science and a new stock assessment is done, we will continue with our regulations and continue our fishery, and we will not comply with the federal law until there is actual sound science that makes sense to a person like me who's not a scientist and can clearly see that this data is ridiculously flawed.
Well, unfortunately, if they did take that stand, they wouldn't be able to, they'd be shut down completely, and the federal government would do that. But I'll let Rob explain the...
I mean, they would just cut down on funding.
Well, not funding.
Funding. You know, I mean, as I tried to say a couple times, going out of compliance has not worked ever since 19. I think the first time it's about with North Carolina, the gray trout and deep fish. They decided not to comply with closing South Hatteras out in the federal water on the what we call a climate fishery, a very strong fishery. Well, they were back in the farm for 6 months. Since then, New Jersey's gone a couple of times. Delaware just did recently with the American deal. It doesn't work, and the penalty is too much.
Well, we could comply with the federal law as far as being 3 miles out. Right. But what about, why can't we manage our fishery in our state waters until sound data?
What I would encourage you to do is, we've got a commission meeting April 26th. I know people work through and all that, but I mean, that's where you really have to express yourself. To a staff person, I can only tell you what I know. That it hasn't worked out that way. And there's some state waters, 82%. Alone took 47% from whatever you think of that estimate of 1.5 million pounds. No one's going to be able to walk away from that. That doesn't mean your ideas shouldn't be shared. Mitch, that's the place to share your ideas.
Isn't there also going to be a meeting on the 22nd?
So there's a meeting on the 22nd, but it's not necessarily public comment, although our commissioner, John Bull, usually does allow some of the public to comment, and that'd be fine too if that's more convenient. I can't guarantee that, but he seems to be that way, that they'll say, well, this is a public hearing, but we don't want your comment.
Okay. I guess my other part of the question is, has anything come up with the meetings? I know you're saying about, you know, limits of boats and stuff like that. Has anybody brought anything up about the economic impact that it's going to do? It's not just charter boat fishermen. I mean, you're talking about tackle shops. You're talking about custom rod builders, custom jig builders like the man behind me. You're talking about marine fabricators that are building towers, boat sales, marinas. I mean, across the board, this is going to be a multi-million-dollar hit on the economy. I mean, this is one of the biggest, or I wouldn't say the biggest fisheries, but it's probably one of the more expensive fisheries in Virginia. I mean, you spend a lot of money to go catch COVID. You don't spend much money drifting over the tube catching flounder by a squid. I mean, I have probably over $10,000 invested, not including my fish, in the COVID fishery.
Yes, there have been. There's
still. Emphasis placed on
beyond 2016. If we're already here.
Well, I mean, the track record, once a fishery starts being regulated, you're just going to continue. Like a red drum fishery, there's plenty of red drum out there, I can tell you for a fact, and we're still not allowed to catch but a slot fish.
You talked about that.
Finally, the same thing. I mean, once this starts, it's the beginning of the end of the Cobia fishery, and then there's basically no more fishing in the bay.
I hope I addressed you.
You did.
Thank you. I'd like to
add something about this. All right, you need to come to the speak. Tell us who you are, if you can help.
My name is Zachary Hoffman. I have my commercial hook and line license, and I also charter fish a lot like a bunch of people in here. I have thousands and thousands of dollars that revolve around this fishery come summertime. That's where I make 80% of my living. And when we're talking about getting a few days, and correct me if I'm wrong, but our release citation is 50 inches. That's a big breeder fish, right? Do they carry more eggs, hatch more fish than a 37 to 40 inch? Right? So why would we want to encourage to kill the bigger fish that are more breeders if the whole reason this has all come about is to help save the fishery? I don't understand that.
Well, I think the reason is that...
All about getting more time. The more time we get, I mean, I make more money doing that. But I don't see where...
I think with the bigger fish, you catch fewer fish. You bring in fewer fish, and that cuts down on the kill.
Well, like George said, he is probably the most conservative person when it comes to... Him and I are out there every single day. Literally, every day. I used to work for him. He lets every big fish go, pretty much, 90%. And especially this year, more than others, I started to do that as well, let more big fish. George and I both could have killed fish over 50 inches every day.
You agree?
Not every day, but...
I just don't understand. Why would we want to encourage to kill something that's 47 inches just to get a couple more days of fishing?
So you would prefer a slot limit, I would take it?
No, I don't prefer a slot limit, no.
Still a science.
Well, there's
I just don't.
So let me give you a little answer because it's, counterintuitive, but think of the way a pyramid is, an age pyramid and a numbers pyramid. At the smaller sizes, as you keep going up, there's more and more fish. Right. So as Jeff said, you take less of the larger fish and you're getting these fish underneath that are recruiting in. That's what the whole basis of spawning potential and everything else is based on. Now, that's the way it's done. Is it correct? Well, I've seen articles, and others have too, where if you think of the older fish, they're much more stable. They've lived. They're stable. And juveniles aren't, but we're not talking about juveniles here. We're still talking about adult fish all the way. So this might be a case where, it'd be hard to say take out the juveniles because you're not taking out juveniles. You're taking out smaller adults, but you're taking out the larger adults now, and the smaller adults are moving in because there are more of them. That's the idea behind it.
I just think some accurate data needs to be done.
We felt that in every fishery that we've ever talked about, unfortunately.
I'm all about that. I just bought a second boat. I plan on doing this. This is my living. So preserving these fish for years to come, I'm all about it. But get some data to show that. Because I can tell you right now, I fish and I know what the fish is like out there. We are not short of cobia. I've been out there. I had days last year when I was in Carolina. I seen over 400 fish in one day with my own two eyes. So I just don't understand how they think completely shutting this down is justifiable. I just don't. There's got to be another way of going about it.
Well, unfortunately, that's the way it's structured. If they have a stock assessment, they set a limit, and if we go over it, we have to pay it back. Now, whether it was set right, whether it's still the same in 2015 or 16 as it was in 2011, unfortunately, it isn't a priority fish for them, and we can only encourage a faster replacement stock assessment. Yeah, I agree. I agree, Bill. Yes, sir.
I sympathize with you guys. This has been happening in what y'all are experiencing now. A lot of people have been experienced with a lot of different fisheries for years. And it'd be nice for Virginia to tell the feds, no, in reality, that's not going to happen. We're lucky we do have Rob Whitman, and he's on it, and he'll try to fight for you and help you. He understands this situation. But in the meantime, we got to come up with something to live with, because it's coming, and you're not going to stop it in the next 30 to 45 days. You guys that are charter fishing, are all you, mostly 90% of your charters on the weekends? Would it be helpful just to have a Friday, Saturday, Sunday fishery and maybe get an extra 3 or 4 weeks? Right, I get it, but you do understand that this is coming. You're not going to, you got to try to help. So would just a Friday, Saturday, Sunday fishery, is that when you have most of your charters? And if you went to just a weekend, Rob, would that extend it maybe 2 or 3 weeks?
Joe has a response for you.
I don't know that would be an option. I mean, that's not, it isn't something that was discussed. So I can't promise that even bringing that to the Southeast Regional Office and asking them to work that up, I don't know if they would consider it.
Just a thought. Reverse situation. I hate to bring up Strike Bass again, but from 1990 through 1994, we had a 30-day and just Thursday to Sunday, and it was a derby style. Everyone wanted to get out there. In 1995, we went to 105-day season, and you could be in the weekdays. And for 2 years, it was the same catch, the same harvest that you have at those 4 days. So I think what we find out here is we get comments and you get the effort more concentrated on the days over. But it's a good thing.
Yeah, and just to the comments made by Rick, you said? Yeah, Rich, sorry. I think the council sees part of the problem. The hurt of a closure, the socioeconomic hurt of a closure, wasn't considered when it should have been considered. You know, so the framework only allowed for the accountability measure to be a closed fishery. And now they are working to reverse that, to give them more tools in the box. Really, the tools that we've been using for years, as as Pete pointed out, I mean, this is old hat for us. You know, we do this. We were doing this every single year for summer flounder. So they're finally getting to that point. It's not going to happen this year. Although the feds are being accommodating to say, in our predictions of a closed season, if we knew you had some options. At no point was playing with days within a week discussed, so I don't know if they would entertain that at all. Or perhaps the possibility of different closure dates. They did talk about rolling closures at the council, and part of that was states saying, look, we should really step up and close during peak spawning time, and that would change the overall season annually. But that didn't go any further at the council.
Is there any kind of new information that their science and statistical committee could use to raise the threshold or the ACL?
Not in the near future, no. And in fact, what Rob's been trying to say, what the head of CDAR who does the assessments trying to say is, don't assume that a new assessment is going to paint a rosy picture. It may go in the opposite direction. And the other, piece that John Carmichael was really trying to drive home, Michelle Duvall was trying to drive home, was that, and Ryan pointed this out, even if they gave us all of Florida's quota and ignored the 300,000 pounds of fish that they killed, we still exceeded the ACL for the whole coast. Bringing Florida back in, who often has very high catches, isn't the savior for anyone. And that's, you know, again, that's what people on the council are trying to point out, that there's going to have to be measures put in place for the future.
Mr. Chairman, may I
comment? She was next.
I wanted to comment in relation to what Zach had said. I agree with wanting to proliferate the fish, of course, and that's one of the reasons why I said when we look at what we need to do in order to extend the season because of this situation, we, over a long period of time, don't want to be fishing at maximum sustainability yield because then overall that's bad. And so I'm wondering, is this something when we decide this option, is there a way we can put like a two-year time frame on it until further data comes? If that be the case, then obviously you would have a different parameter to look at.
Yeah. I mean, it's as far as right now, as far as what we're talking about presenting to asking, you know, the feds to give back to us as options, you know, we're talking about going to the commission for 2016. And as I mentioned, the council is looking at changing the framework in the future. So I would expect that this would be, you know, a moving target as far as management measures.
Okay. Yes, please.
Sure. I think what everybody's driving at, there's something wrong here. It really is. One thing, if the best fishermen we probably have out here, which are the commercial fishermen, they're making a living at it. If they're only catching 88%, or what it was, 85%,
okay,
there's something wrong. They should be getting 130% if we're actually receding. The regular... What the problem I really suspect is the assessment, not just the stock assessment, which I'm sure is off because I see them also just by a spot. I'm out there probably half the time, and I see also lots of cobia. But also the effort assessment, the voodoo science to come up with the assessment doesn't work. The targeting of it, the questions asked at the assessment is probably good, but the precision of it is so bad that it should be thrown out and not even considered. I think that's really what the problem is, and that's where we're exceeding, quote-unquote, the ACL. Look, when they take and go check the, do their samples, how they do the sample. They're sucked, they go to a dock or a landing, and they check people coming in. Okay. Or they call. Well, fishermen are liars to start with, so you got to expect a little of that. But beyond that, they go from the timing of their surveys are controlled by funding. You don't go early in the morning. You don't go late at night.
Well, they do
so
all different
problem. Time. It's precision.
Okay. Yeah, there are problems with... In rooms for error in the surveys, there are rooms for error in all the science that we've got, but that's what we have to deal with today.
That's it.
Unfortunately.
Just unfortunately, the stock assessment probably is off.
It may very well be from what we're hearing, or at least
that's what's making everybody frustrated.
Too old, yeah.
Reducing.
Welcome.
Again, we know there's more fish out there.
Welcome to fisheries management. If you were relying on black sea bass, You could be saying exactly the same thing.
Yep.
There's too many fish. We can't keep our numbers down.
Mm-hmm. Counting the fishes in the ocean is very difficult.
And yes, sir.
One thing I say, if we brought Florida's poundage back, we would have been over by about 29%, which would have increased our season likely into September, maybe.
But that's from a different stock, they say, so that we can't really transfer that to us.
To claim that it's not a saving grace, but also if you average out the ACL for the past 4 years, we're only at 90%. We're actually still 10% below what it's been for a year.
Right, and if it was a normal year where they didn't have the 2014 assessment, we'd be working on a three-year average instead of... Yeah, so.
And I mean, even the Gulf Coast caught 2 million pounds back to back in 2003 and 2004, and that went into their average. We don't do this.
I agree. There's
They did use a three-year average.
They did.
These numbers are based on a three-year average. Michael Larkin used 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Not the ACL. He used 3 years to come up with these numbers, average.
What I read was different, but okay. That's what we've got, at least. Anything else from the table? All right, so we'll wait on your information, your response from National Marine Fisheries, sir.
My last item is to say that the only change I'm going to propose to miss is take the size limit, minimum size limit, up to 41 inches fork length, which is about 45 inches total length. That's best suggestion. I'll do that in the morning. The other thing to remind everyone, the bulletin that came out, I think everyone knows this, for June 20th, will be modified by whatever, you know, the happenings at National Marine Fisheries Service, whatever that all works out to be, whatever North Carolina goes through its process in May, which is about the 25th, we go through our process April 26th, so obviously that June 20th is going to change. It's just that no one knows by how much. So just be aware of that. I don't want anyone leaving thinking everything's going to close June 20th.
Mr. Chairman, question for what do you think is a realistic hope total time for extending this season past the 20th of June? No guess at all?
No, because we know the boat limit is not going to give us a whole lot based on the fact that the data, and they didn't sample a lot of charter and, you know, all that. The size limit, I think the size limit is the biggest, has the biggest clout. I just don't know how much. And part of that problem is we don't have all the data to sort of mock that kind of scenario.
Sure, just come up and give us your name.
My name is Dave Gressens from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Two comments, just to echo what I think what you've already heard several times. Size and creel limits are like taxes and fees. Once they change, we never get them back. So the gravity with which you consider these changes has to be paramount. I had the privilege of speaking with the Honorable Whitman in Pocosin at the high school last Saturday. For the gentleman who said he's been in touch, and I have been and will be in touch as well. One of the things that I intend to present to him and that I ask folks here to consider is that the navigable waters of the state of Virginia are much greater than Georgia, New York. We have the Chesapeake Bay and its tributaries, and therefore we are being asked to bear a disproportionate burden of this catch and this limit. We have more square miles, acres of navigable waters. We have more boats. We have more captains. We have more fish. And the data doesn't reflect that. So I'm asking everybody, as the advisory council and also as the chair, to take this into account. And hopefully we can get some help from the Honorable Whitman. But these are very important things to consider and not to be taken lightly and not to just say one time, we don't want to be the state that bucks the feds. Maybe this is the time for us to be the state that bucks the feds. Because science is not telling us what our eyes see and our hearts believe. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. If you're in Rob Whitman's territory, then... it might help to send him a letter as well. He is a hardcore fisherman. His office on Capitol Hill is filled with stuffed fish. It's very impressive. So And if he's not your congressman, then find out who is and get them to join on with Rob Whitman.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Can I make one more comment?
Yes, sir.
I've talked with a lot of people about this.
Pull the mic up, please.
I've talked with everybody on the East Coast about this. Michael Larkin, Sue Gearhart, down in NOAA Southeast Regional Office. Whatever we propose will have little to no effect because these fish are coming up from North Carolina. If North Carolina doesn't take hard changes, which I don't believe they will because they already went down to one fish, you know, their residents believe that they've done a lot already. But whatever we decide isn't going to matter because, you know, our fish aren't caught until almost after the proposed closure anyway. So I don't want people to have false hope because I believe whatever we agree to try to ask them to do will have very to little effect on it. And I get that from talking with everyone that I've talked to. The other thing that the other gentleman just mentioned, and I talked to Sue Gearhart about this and some others about Virginia following or not following. Normally, I would never say that we should go against the feds, but Virginia was taken out of this decision 2 years ago when it started. You know, we didn't have an input. The representative on the Mid-Atlantic Council is a non-voting person. So when these rules were written, they didn't expect it to go over. Well, it did go over. So why should Virginia bear the burden for the whole East Coast? Granted, we were the major contributor to the overage, but North Carolina was as well. So if ever Virginia was going to buck the feds, this is the time to do it. You know, it's only right because North Carolina will get 95% of their season, roughly. And they are not going to lower things. They're not going to cut their fish down to one fish per boat. You can hope that they will, but it won't happen. So if Virginia is ever going to buck the system, this would be the right time to do it, you know, to protect. I mean, the charter guys, Randy at Wallace's will go out of business. There's a lot at stake here, you know, for the tackle shops, the charter guys, and everybody. And we, by it closing on the 20th, Virginia loses, I would say, 90% of their season. And what the commission or has been requested to extend it, it won't be 5 days, I guarantee you, when Mike figures this out. If ever we're going to buck the system, now is the time to do it, to protect Virginia's interest in it.
All right. Thank you.
I second the motion to buck the feds. All in favor?
Well, you might want to come before the commission and if you can break away and let them know that, because that'll be their decision, of course. Yes, sir. Orange shirt. I'm sorry.
As a continuation of what was just said, I don't know how many of y'all know, but there is a small group out there that is trying to fight the feds for breaking the Magnuson-Stevens Act. If you read the act, the national standards, I believe it's number actually. National standard number 4 says that it will not discriminate between residents of states. You know, obviously, if 90% of our fishery is gone, I think that's a little bit of a discrimination. Standard number 8, take into accordance importance of fisheries resources to fishing communities by utilizing economic and social data. Again, it's obvious. So I just wonder if the board or the VMRC has considered joining, because if this fight does go through, having a state on board against the feds, if we're going to buck them, would only help our cause.
Yeah, I know that in the past, using number 8, the courts have ruled that number 1 is the most important, and they don't pay much attention to number 8, but that doesn't mean they wouldn't this time. So, go ahead.
I'll explain a little bit on the socioeconomic stuff, because I can tell you how I worked on the commercial side.
this is a very important fishery to you. But overall, that's what they compare it to. Just like, you know, some of our commercial fisheries are very important to us. Now, it might be a $10 million fishery, and it might be really affecting me because that's my main source of living. But they won't compare that to something similar. They'll say it's only $10 million out of a billion-dollar fishery, so it's inconsequential. That's how they write off everything on the socioeconomic part. They compare it to the big overall picture instead of apples to apples, thinking with apples and oranges. So that's the reason you never get any traction on the socioeconomic stuff, because they use the big overall picture.
Sorry, gentlemen. All right, should we move on to triggerfish?
I do have a few slides, but I would really recommend with a night like this that we wait. It's actually
fine.
At CDAR right now, so
thank you.
They'll have a new assessment. You know, we.
Well, if it doesn't need to be done tonight, we
no,
don't.
No, not at all. The
okay.
reason why we did put it on the agenda is because there was one individual that wants to get a discussion started on possible management measures. And I think it's perfectly acceptable to do that at another time. And I think it's a good idea to wait because it is at CDAR right now. So they'll have a new assessment very soon.
All right. Any other new business to come before the committee?
I got one quick question.
Quick.
I'm getting a lot of calls on electric shock. And can you give me any update?
This is
it's still up in the air. From what I know. At least from the commissioner's aspect, it would be one more year of the grant, one more year of one individual on the grant, but Ben hasn't really finalized that from what I know.
You might know better than I do.
I'm a member of the Fisheries Resource Grant Committee, and we discussed this just a couple of weeks ago. The fellow from Pocosin requested another rig this year, and we gave him some money, but there's been a lot of talk. You've probably heard it from other fishermen that kind of feel like this electric shock fishing is interfering with their normal catch, and they're a little bit concerned about how it's affecting their part of the fishery up there. This, for everybody's information, this is about blue catfish, mostly in the James River, but a little bit everywhere. And however, I think all the conversation that everybody got was they from the regular net fishermen was that they didn't particularly like the electro shock fishing, but they were real interested to figure out how to get into it. it's something that I think this grant situation is going to go on at least one more year before they decide whether they're going to try to issue any more experimental permits. And a lot of it really depends on the data that they get from it, what VIM's opinion is going to be on it, and what Game and Inland Fisheries thinks of it. So it's not going to be just a VMRC decision.
Yeah, so everything that's been done so far has been done on a grant that is been set up for looking at fishing gear, and so they are. It sounds like they do have some money to. They put forth a proposal to look at one more aspect of that gear for. So the grant will continue for one more year.
Our concern is here's another year with all these migratory fish coming in and getting eat up. And the quicker we can get more people out there shocking the fish, the more fish we can get rid of.
Well, let me tell you what the numbers are. He caught, I think, last year in the neighborhood of 125,000 pounds. He's planning on increasing his effort this year and catching in the neighborhood of 400,000.
That's not a drop in the bucket.
No, I know, but that's you know, there a market is developing for these things. They're averaging 50, 60 cents a pound, a little bit more the further north you go. There's a couple guys on the Potomac that are haul seining the fish. They're actually baiting them where they're fishing. I don't know what they're using for bait, whether it's corn or dog food or whatever it is, anything that they'll consume, and then they're wholesaling them. And the markets have become very receptive to the product. How far they'll go with letting more of these electroshock fishing rigs go, I don't know, because there is some concern about how they're affecting sturgeon, and you know how they're super protected. They don't know whether it's going to affect any of their mating habits or feeding habits or what's going on, but it's an interesting thing.
I need to catch a catfish with a sturgeon in his belly.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's exactly right. You do that, they'll all be gone.
Yeah, Robin, that's
easy.
They don't believe.
What's that?
The larval sturgeon.
Oh, yeah, they probably. Is that right?
All right. The next meeting, what dates?
You're going to see an email from us about either the 18th or 19th.
Okay.
I don't move until the chairman says that he's available. And then we'll send out an email.
18th.
He's retired. He's got a blank calendar.
18th is cleared. 19th I can clear. So. The 18th is clear for me. The 19th I can clear. I can skip.
Let's talk later.
All right.
Early next week.
Yes, sir. Motion to adjourn. Second. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you, everybody.
You got a clear calendar. You're retired.
Yeah.
Just throw that thing in the trash.
Yeah. Well, I've just noticed the glass is broken. I mean,
I got to get a little sturgeon for him somewhere so I can put in that cat.
That's what I'm going to do.
You know, a carrying his arbor's on. And to catch sturgeon, they have to do, you know, full write-up and stuff. So they stay in them with a thing, because if they're hatchery raised, they got a little bait. I said, well, how many have you actually hatchery raised?
None.
I said, have you done many? He says, a lot. Further north, because he just started coming down last fall. I haven't been since the first day of January. He said he's never caught one. So I asked the next observer, somebody completely different. He's never had one. So they're all wild. So that gives you an idea. They're full of them.
Yeah.
And they know they are, because that's the reason they're bending over backwards.
Yeah. Well, that's why they gave, what's his name, so much trouble. The guy who used to come in here all the time. Worked a lot on sturgeon, but he had tons of samples of DNA from